It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott, Mary Jo Foley, lots to talk about. It's the end of the line for Internet Explorer. We hardly knew ye. We'll talk about 2004. Mary Jo finally gets hers. And Paul has a first look at the new Microsoft Teams display hardware. Yes, it's all coming up next on Windows Weekly. Windows Weekly comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley, episode 686, recorded Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. The impression of fairness. This episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by Adobe Sign. Business needs to keep moving, whether people are working together or apart. With Adobe Sign, working remote actually works. Learn more about what Adobe Sign can do for your business at adobe.com/businessmoves. And by LastPass. Allow your remote workforce the ability to do their best work without jumping through hoops. Ensure your business's security with LastPass. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. And by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Microsoft. Here they are, the dynamic duo of Microsoft reporting. From allaboutmicrosoft.com and ZDNet.com, it's Ms. Mary Jo Foley. Hello, Mary Jo.
Hello, Leo.
Hello.
Goodbye, heart.
Hello, Mary Jo. Goodbye, love. It's Paul Thurrott on the left. He is from Thurrott.com and his book's at leanpub.com. Hello, you two.
Hello.
Welcome to the ash-strewn, twilight-lit end of times, Northern
political
California.
Apocalyptic hell.
I look out California. The window, I see smoke. And
it's Ash Wednesday.
It is. It's a little early this year.
Not the usual Ash Wednesday.
Yeah. I woke up, there was ash on our deck. Little fine white ash everywhere. It looked like it snowed.
Yeah,
you should have been a snowman.
An ash man. A fitting figure for our times.
Yeah.
Wow. All we're missing is an earthquake, gang, and...
Oh, don't say that.
Do you guys get tornadoes ever? Yet? I should say.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Just a matter of time. No hurricanes. Mm. So, speaking of tornadoes, what the heck is going on with the browser thing at Microsoft?
Browser thing.
I just read a very good piece about how Google is eating the world. And we're really getting, and because, well, Firefox, you know, is struggling, and the Mozilla Foundation. Right. Google just did a deal to, you know, give them an influx of about $400 million this year. But nevertheless.
No, my take on that was literally this will keep the company afloat until 2025.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
You know? Yeah. We just got to keep it alive so that we don't get dinged by.
What does that remind you of, by the way? What does that remind you of anything?
Microsoft bailing out Apple?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly. Have it's like, look, we still have competition.
Yeah.
The number two in the market is still here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, that worked out. So.
Meanwhile, the new Edge, or as you call it, Credge, based on the Chromium engine, is now the one and only, the king, the ruling king of Windows.
Sort of. Not quite
yet. Yeah, this is kind of complicated.
I know. So a lot of people didn't realize until this week that Microsoft is still supporting Internet Explorer. But yes, they are, because many enterprises have built apps on top of it. So they have to keep it alive for them. But they did make a little foray towards phasing it out this week. They said, you know what? We're going to give you a timetable for when we're no longer going to support IE 11 with Microsoft Teams. And that's happening this year, November 30th. And then next year, 1 year from Monday, so August 17th, 2021, you can't use IE 11 anymore with your Microsoft 365 apps all up. So then people assume, oh, so that's the deadline for when IE is no longer supported. No, that's not the deadline.
Yeah, and, in fact, and they have not announced a deadline, unfortunately.
No, they haven't.
Because there will be one, right? I mean, there will be one.
It's so confusing
what complicates this?
I know. So the reason it's complicated is IE 11 is technically considered part of the operating system for older versions of Windows. So you would think, okay, so it's going to be supported as long as Windows 8.1. Is that what that means? No, it doesn't mean that either, which is what I thought. Microsoft just says it'll be supported as long as the versions of Windows on which it runs are supported. So I went back several times this week and asked, so does it mean this time? Does it mean this date? Nope. So the answer is we don't know when the end date is for IE 11.
There's no way to tell. Here's the complication, right? It comes in Windows 10, right?
Yeah, so it's still in Windows 10, right?
And as long as it's still in Windows 10, technically it will be supported. Windows 10 throws a wrench into support because, you know, Windows 8.1 and earlier versions of Windows, 10-year life cycle. So maybe you know off the top of your head, I don't remember when Windows 8.1 expires from a support perspective, but it's a few years down the road.
2025 or 26, somewhere around there maybe.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I would say that that's probably the furthest out that they'll actually support it. That's my guess, but they've not said that.
Yeah.
Because I think at some point what they'll do is there'll be a version of Windows 10. It could be
2023. It's 2023 for Windows 8.1. Yeah.
So honestly, tying it to that would make sense to me. They could, you know, make it such that it's not installed by default in Windows 10, and then they just remove it from Windows 10. Edge, of course, has like a backwards compatibility mode anyway.
Yeah.
And versions of Windows 10 don't have 10-year life cycle support life cycles. They have, you know, it varies depending on the type of contract. Yeah. Two-ish years. So, So, I mean, I honestly, they haven't said it, so we literally can't say this is when it's officially dead. But I think the 8.1 expiration of support is a good goal, you know, a good possibility.
Yeah, I wish they would give us a little more of a hint. All the blog post says is, "Don't worry, IE 11 is not going away." And so many developers were like, no.
That is what we're worried about. I think you've misunderstood the worry.
I know. Yeah. People are like, but they mean next year, right? I'm like, no, they don't mean next year. They don't mean next year.
No, but, you know, but look, they can soft kill it, meaning they make their services not work properly or at all, right?
Right. So, and that's what's happening. Possible. That's what's starting to happen, right?
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And then Edge, legacy Edge, the old Edge, whatever you want to call it, the not Credge Edge. You know the one I mean?
The not Credge Edge.
Also Edge, also known as Edge.
Nedge.
And so is the new Edge. Yeah.
Or Ledge.
So Ledge, that's good. I like that. Ledge. So as of March 9th next year, Microsoft's no longer supporting any security updates for legacy Edge desktop app. So they're calling that the end of life date for legacy Edge.
Now, this is, you said March of next year.
Yeah, 2021.
Yeah, that's pretty aggressive because the current version of Edge, the new Edge, or, you know, Credge, just came out in January, I mean, officially. Yep. So that's barely a year. It's over a year, but it's short.
Yeah, I guess because they're going to be preloading Credge with 20H2, they're like, okay, so we're giving you Edge. You're going to have it in Windows starting then.
You know, we don't have notes about this, but there is a bit of controversy out in the world right now about Edge because it is being installed for seekers who go to Windows Update. Mm-hmm. It requires a reboot, which is also semi-controversial for some reason, but one of the problems is once you install the new Edge, you can't go back. You can't get rid of it, you know?
Right.
That's bugging some people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, but I mean, why does it bug people? Why can't you just hide it? If you don't want to see it, hide it.
Well, I mean, you can set a new default, of course. But here's, by the way, so this is just a weird coincidence, but sometime in the past 24, 48 hours, whatever, I clicked on something in Windows 10 on some computer. It's hard for me because I have so many different PCs, but it actually brought up IE. And when IE comes up, you get that little dialogue where it says, you know, do you want these settings or whatever? And it's like, what that's tied to is that Microsoft actually made it more complicated in Windows 10 to set everything to go to the new Edge. Because there's a setting for, like, I want this to be the default. But in the old days, in the early versions of Windows 10 and previous versions of Windows, you could go to a control panel interface and say, set this to all the defaults. And now what you have to do is do it by protocol or file type or whatever. And that's monotonous because you actually have to go through a list. You can't just choose the browser and say, I do it for everything. You have to select the protocol. So, of course, no one does that. And what that means is that IE is associated with some legacy protocol or some, URL type or whatever it is. And so every once in a while, you'll actually see IE pop up on your computer. Today. And I just experienced this. I experienced it from time to time, but it literally just happened to me. So anyway, but that's a side issue. So to your point, though, to your question, I guess. Sorry.
You can uninstall Credge if you use PowerShell, right? Like there's a way if you really, really want to do it.
I'm not even 100% sure. I don't know why anyone would do that. I sort of feel like this is a lot like the situation with IE back in the day where there are system components that apps need. And I mean, why worry about this? The shell of the application that was Edge or IE back in the day was pretty small. A lot of that is back-end components. Now that might be different with the new Edge because it's based on Chromium. I'm not really 100% sure, but I think what's freaking people out is, maybe they're a Chrome user, Firefox user, whatever, and they just don't want any Microsoft browser on their computer. And it's that whole, it's my computer. Why can't I do what I want? Yeah. That kind of thing. But I think it's tied to system components and those back-end, web renderers and so forth that apps rely on. I think that's what it is.
It's kind of sneaky how they did this too, because if you manually installed Credge, it looked like in your options you could uninstall it. But then once you get the first update for it, then you no longer can uninstall it.
It changes the options. I don't know if they're privacy people or just security people, whatever. But I've seen some people have said, like, this is how malware behaves. I don't think Microsoft, I don't think anyone thinks really that Microsoft is trying to do anything malicious, but they do things like this. It's sort of like the telemetry stuff in Windows 10, where I think the intent is good, but they just don't give you the option that some people really want, and it makes it feel less than, I don't know, honorable or something. It's weird.
I know. Yeah, I get what they're doing, but I'm also kind of like, all right, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, look, Edge came with Windows 10. The new Edge will come with Windows 10.
It will.
It makes sense that this is a thing. Look, it's a system component. I mean, whether you want it or not. I mean,
I know. I think the part that got people kind of tangled up about this was they made a big deal when they came out with Credge that the browser is no longer part of the operating system. It can be updated separately, blah, blah, blah. It's a separate app, right? So then you're like, okay, if it's an app, why can't I get rid of it? It's not the OS.
Yeah, but it's okay.
That's what people say, right?
No, I understand that. If you look at stuff like WinUI 3 or what they're doing with Project Reunion, and what we've seen on mobile, Google has done this with system components that they've turned into like apps as a service through the Play Store. Mm-hmm. It's possible Apple has done something similar. I'm not really sure on that side. Yeah. But, there's a goodness of it's not tied to a particular version of the operating system and it can be updated at any time, which could be important for security reasons or whatever. These things are serviced outside of the OS lifecycle or whatever. So, like, that's good. But there's also the distinction that, well, it's still part of the operating system, and the browser takes on a particular role that's a little different from, I'm trying to think of an app, like a music app or a, even a calendar email app or whatever. There are still back-end components that are used by other apps. So, I mean, I think it's a little different.
You could say, Credge, it's no Candy Crush. That's your slogan. Well,
that's true.
That's a selling point. Yeah.
Here comes the browser police.
Candy Crush has that superpower where you uninstall it and then you check for updates in the store and you get it back.
The crush came back the very next day. Oh, the crush came back. We thought
just
it was
in case
a goner.
You know, maybe
you might want it. You did it by accident. Surely. Yeah. Everybody wants Candy Crush.
Just run it. Just run it. Run it.
Run it, please. Oh, Ego Vault.
I think we have the entire fire department out here now.
I hear it. I hear it.
They're right
out
here.
That's not me. It should be me. I'm the one on fire.
I know.
But
it should be you.
Maybe this is all a simulation.
Right.
I'm just saying.
Our world. It kind of feels like
I sleep poorly, and sometimes in the middle of the night I'll wake up and it seems like I'm in a pod on a giant wall of pods.
Yeah.
And
plugged in.
You normally would
button.
Be terrifying, but these days it's kind of comforting.
Yeah. At least you're safe in your pod.
Yeah.
All the
warm.
Rest of the stuff.
Yeah.
Comfy.
Yeah. Yep.
Hey, let's take a little break and come back. There's lots more to talk about. 2004. There's a big celebration. I'm going to have to get Cool and the Gang ready here.
Oh, yeah. Get it ready.
Yep.
Virtual confetti machine going. Yep.
I did watch the Surface Duo video. We'll talk a little bit about that. Okay. I am still happy, even though the entire tech press has agreed it's a terrible, terrible thing.
Well, but
we're going to talk about it.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting, I don't want to call it a debate, a conversation.
We'll have that. We'll have that conversation because I'm already, I'm all in. $1,500 in. In fact, I can't wait to get it. Oh, did you buy it? Oh, let's talk about it. All right. We're going to talk about that in just a sec. But first, a word from our sponsor. A sponsor I can get behind because I am so sick, and it still happens, of getting an email saying, please print this. Fill out the form, sign it, and then fax it back to us. As if this is somehow magically more secure than Adobe Sign. I wish just the world needs to wake up. Wake up, world! And use Adobe Sign. Your signers will love it. It's more secure. A pen and ink signature is not secure. Not secure. If you're running a business right now with everything going on, you might be facing some challenges, you know? No matter what's happening, though, the world keeps moving. Your business needs to keep moving. And that's where Adobe Sign can really help. Adobe Sign has now processed more than 8 billion with a B transactions from millions of signers all over the world, small startups all the way up to global organizations. It's a really great way to get e-signatures. They are fully legal. They are verifiable. They comply with regulatory requirements. And there's no in-person pen handling, if you know what I mean. E-signatures improve efficiencies across all the departments for all the important work you have to get done, whether it's requests for permits, or construction planning, or health services, even internal operations, human resources, procurement, IT. And I love it because you can make it automatic. Employees can do it themselves. It's employee-driven, self-serve workflows make it easy to initiate and track signing processes. And there's so much more you can do with Adobe Sign than you can do with plain pen and paper. You can enforce deadlines. You can archive final documents automatically, complete with audit trails. You're going to save time and money, and it's more secure. It's enterprise-grade security and compliance. Certified compliant. It can be configured to allow organizations to meet whatever industry-specific requirements you have. HIPAA, of course, in the health industry, FERPA, in the financial services, GLBA, and more. E-signature processes protect sensitive information. They are legal. Here's another high point. They're accessible. That's nice. And they enforce the regulatory and policy rules you're subject to automatically. Legal e-signatures let you choose from a variety of signer identification methods. So, you can verify the signer, including, requiring, if you wish, U.S. government IDs, or you can use certificate-based employee IDs, PIV, CAC cards, that kind of thing. And it's a system that is so easy to use, so easy to integrate into the applications you already use, whether it's Microsoft 365 or Salesforce, ServiceNow, Workday. And they have APIs as well. Very good APIs. So, of course, it's Adobe, so you can get the most bang for your buck. And as a signer, let me just tell you, it makes me, I go, oh, happy day when I get the email that says, click here, click here, click here, you're done. Hallelujah. And, of course, you can track and manage the process. You'll know exactly the status of every signature of every document. You're not waiting for the fax to come in. Fax, really? Fax, really? No, Adobe Sign. If you're still waiting, you can automatically send reminders. You can cancel requests and more. Contracts get signed. Loans get approved. Deals get done faster than ever before. Adobe Sign has solutions for any type of company, from small businesses to global companies. It's a great way to go, and I just wish everybody would start using it now. Keep your business moving with Adobe. Learn more about Adobe Sign and what it can do for your business if you go to Adobe, A-D-O-B-E, adobe.com/businessmoves. Adobe.com/businessmoves. Business moves with Adobe. You know Adobe. Get to know Adobe Sign. Adobe.com/businessmoves. It's a moving. Speaking of moving, 2004 on Mary Jo's Surface laptop. Did you go
it
seeking?
Happened.
Did you go seeking?
I saw all these people saying, I got it on my Surface laptop. Like over the weekend, I get about 20 yeah. emails from people like, you should check, you should check. So Monday morning, I checked and there it was. So then I debated, should I get it or not get it? Because now I'm afraid, right? Jeez.
After months of waiting, so, it's like, I don't know if I want this.
I know. And then I'm like, oh, what if it bricks my machine? This will be terrible, blah, blah, blah. So then I'm like, no, all right, I'm going to hit install. So it's doing its thing, going along. I kept checking on it. An hour and a half later, I'm like, okay, I think it's there now.
It's a big
and
download. I didn't realize 32
it's
gigabytes. It's huge.
I know. Yeah. And so then I'm like, of course, in the middle of doing a podcast, and all of a sudden the prompt comes up, we're about to restart your machine. And I'm like, wait, I have this set not to do this. And here it comes, right? So I'm like frantically hitting the button like, no, not now, not now. And finally I got it to stop. And then I did it later. So yeah, about an hour and a half and everything worked. All my files were right where I left them.
It's not just marketing, so folks.
It's true.
It happened, yeah. And so also today I saw a number of people with the Surface Pro X, you know, the ARM-based Surface Pro X, saying, I finally can get it on my machine too. And so I'm seeing about, I'd say, maybe 75% of people who are trying now on the Pro X saying, yes, I got it. And other people saying, nope, I still can't get it on the Pro X.
So based on what I've seen, same as you, email and Twitter, all the feedback, yeah. I think the blockers on most of the Surface devices are off. I think the people who aren't getting it have another blocker. They have some kind of peripheral or something yeah. that is triggering that. But it really feels like the shackles have kind of come off. So what are we, mm-hmm. three months later?
Three months about. Yeah.
So just in time to
for 20H2. I know. I'm like, and start it's almost time for the next one. Yeah, I think yeah. what happened was there was like firmware updates, and then they removed a bunch of the blockers too. But there's, like you said, if you go to the release information page, there's still blockers on there.
Oh, yeah, No, but I think in the case of your device in particular and other Surface PCs, those firmware updates, which are, you know, driver updates by and large, but also literally like firmware updates to the UEFI or whatever it's called these days, is what got it off the list and made it possible to upgrade.
I think so. So yeah, it's working. It's on my machine.
You must have noticed all kinds of big differences. Okay. So are you enjoying all the changes?
So just for fun, I'm like, you know what I should do just for fun? I should try to install Ubuntu just because why not? You know?
Yeah.
So, but then I remembered, oh wait, I'm using the Home Edition. So I don't think I have virtualization capability. So I do now. I knew where they were going to add it, but I didn't know when they were going to add it.
You know, it's there. So what they did was separated out the part of virtual. It's so you don't see the Hyper-V platform, but I think it's called Microsoft virtualization or Windows virtualization, but I don't even know that you have to enable it manually. I think you can just install it.
Really?
I think, but you can't.
I was reading instructions. They're like, open PowerShell. I'm like, okay, this is already going to be a bad idea for me, but let's go.
It does require some. It's possible I never write up about this.
I actually didn't do it. I got distracted and I didn't, but I thought it would have been funny if I took a picture of me running Ubuntu. That would have been like, okay.
I think everyone listening and watching this would agree that what we need to hear is that Mary Jo has switched to Emacs or Vim or.
Yay!
Yeah.
Sometime.
I'll say Leo finally won me over and yay. I'm a Vim.
Then at that moment, frogs start falling from the sky. A giant crack will open between California and the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Hell will freeze over. All those kind of biblical apocalyptic warnings.
Exactly. But yeah, I can say even my at first I was worried because I had a ton of tabs open in Edge and I was like, oh, should have done something with that, like save those tabs somewhere or done something. But when my browser came up after a few minutes, all the tabs came back. I was like, oh, no, there they are.
Yeah. And if they didn't, you can go into history and they'll be there. You can actually just do a one click.
That's what I was like, oh, I can get them out of history. Right. So, yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, everything works
great.
So you know? Far.
Yeah. Good.
Yep.
Was it worth the wait?
So for me, like, I don't see anything.
What's
literally.
The difference?
I don't see anything different.
Yeah.
At all. I mean, maybe I know WSL2 is the big reason a lot of people really wanted this version, but otherwise, is there anything I would see or notice here? No. Right?
Nope. And most people don't need or want WSL anyway, so whatever.
I mean, normal people.
You're
don't.
Technical enough. Right. You need WSL. You probably force installed this thing months ago.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Like
you're running Linux in a VM, or running it.
You're doing
natively.
It some other
you're
way.
Doing it some other way.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just waiting for my mom to call me because she will when this starts downloading, and she'll be like, "It's been an hour. What is happening?"
I had a guy on the radio show who said it's been going on for hours, and he said, "I only have 32 gigs free on my drive." I mean, I think actually it was one of those HP streams. It was 32 gigs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's going to be a tough install.
It's not. Yeah. It's a 32 gig download. So I said, you could get the Microsoft Media Creation tool and get 2004 in that. Put that on a USB key where unaccountably it only requires 16 gigs.
There used to be something that I think was called Windows Ready, which for machines like the HP Stream that had small amounts of disk storage, it was basically a USB key that act as kind of a cache for stuff.
Yeah, so that's a good way to do it.
So, yeah.
How can a company, I sell a 32 gig hard drive. That's just either that or how can Microsoft offer a 32 gig update? I don't know which is more ridiculous.
I know.
I remember my first 2 gig hard drive. Wasn't that long ago, and I was so excited. And then we got 4 gigs, and you had to partition it because the BIOS couldn't see more than 2 gigs.
The file system couldn't go over
file system. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Two. Actually, my first hard drive was a PC MCIA device that was 20 megabytes.
Oh, well, let's not get there because I can beat you on that one. I bought a $4,000 5 megabyte hard drive.
I attached mine to an Amiga 500.
That's pretty good.
That's esoteric as it gets.
Yeah. No, I remember we were all excited when the new MFM 20 megabyte drives came out. If somebody told me, in 30 years, just to update Windows, you'll need 32 gigabytes.
Yeah. Not to mention that those hard drives, which were multiple physical platters and sounded like the transmission of a 76 Oldsmobile when they were actually, being accessed. It was like using technology from vinyl records to write and read data. It's just the weirdest.
How much space do you need for Flight Simulator?
Yeah, all of it. How much space do you have?
That's the question.
It would be a shame if anything happened to your storage.
How much do you have?
You didn't need a swap disk, did you?
some kid in the chat room saying, wait a minute. You mean terabytes, right? No.
No,
we mean megabytes.
Yeah. No, I mean, I just did this is for later, but I just did something with MP3 files. And some of those files are 11 to 16 megabytes, which means my first hard drive could have stored one or two of them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I take 40 megabyte photos now.
Yeah, right.
One photo, one picture wouldn't have fit on any. Well, my BBS
granted, this is
running
a computer
on
that, you know, would draw like a fractal landscape over a weekend. You know, like, wasn't exactly a lot of computing power there.
It's amazing. Yeah. Is this the largest? This must be the largest update ever. I mean, that's a lot.
For Windows?
Yeah. It's 32 gigs.
Well, is it 32 gigs or does it just require that much space on the disk?
Because right.
I think.
Oh, okay. So the download's not that big, but it has to have free space to expand. That makes sense.
People kind of lose sight of this because, and this is why I always say, you know, Microsoft's rebranding of version upgrades to feature updates creates a situation where it sounds like it's not as dangerous or as big of a deal as it used to be, but it is just as dangerous as it ever was. And if you do a clean install of a new, you know, of Windows, and you have an existing version of Windows, you do an upgrade or whatever, it actually partitions the disk, it moves your stuff aside, it blows the new version of Windows down, and if it's an upgrade, it pushes everything back. It's actually kind of a miracle that this ever works. But, you know, this is kind of the way it works. I mean, that's why you need space.
Yeah, you're right. It's a 4 gigabyte download, but it needs, so I misunderstood, needs 32 gigs free space. That makes sense.
Which would be tough on a 32 gigabyte screen.
Yeah. You can erase everything.
I'm not mistaken, probably has eMMC storage too. So not only is it not a lot of space, but it's nice.
Yeah, they were trying to say, oh, yeah, you could do a Chromebook with Windows. Nope.
Well, I mean, some Chromebooks have 64 or more, I guess, maybe. I mean, it would be a tough one. Yeah, that'd be tough.
That's what the stream was trying to be, a Windows-based Chromebook.
It was a cute little computer.
Oh, yeah, it was cute. Cheap, cute.
Purple.
Yep. I was just reading at Computer World, Ask Woody. The last sentence of his column is, there's no reason for normal Windows users to install 2004 just yet. Sit back and wait.
Yeah.
Until the dust clears.
He's a sit back and wait kind of guy
Woody Leonard.
Yeah. But he also tracks every single problem that occurs with every single release.
Which is great.
And
I know.
Yeah. I mean, if you care about that stuff, there is no one on this earth who does more work in this area than he does.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Agree.
He's right on top of it.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the guy to read before you do it, I guess.
Yeah, especially, if you're worried about this. I mean, I guess, you know, it's a semi-alarmist position, but it's also born of great experience.
I mean, we need a Chicken Little, you know? I mean, it's not the only point of view, but we need one Chicken Little.
No.
Right. Yeah, there's acid rain falling. Why don't you step outside and see if it hurts? You know, if it does, I'll write about it. Then other people won't.
He gets the Microsoft people all like riled up because he's like, you know, I know when these Patch Tuesday updates come out, you should just wait a little and make sure it's not going to brick your machine. And they're like, no, apply them immediately. And
it's
like,
Okay, good. Good. I'm
Windows
glad you
10
got it.
Record of reliability stands for itself.
I am just so glad you got it because
me too. I know. Yeah. Now I feel like I'm one of the cool kids, although I won't be for that long when 2082 comes out.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, what's the soonest you think that would appear? Probably September, but probably October, right?
Yeah. Next month, so maybe.
you get a couple of months, you're going to be on the leading edge. It's nice.
That's true. I'll bask in my credge glory.
And then 6 months will go by and we'll begin wondering why you're not getting it again.
Exactly.
So, by the way, Credge is good. Credge is really good.
Yeah.
It's a nice,
it's
nice
good.
Browser.
It is good.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's like probably, if you're using Windows, it's, you know, probably the one you want to use. I'm encouraging people to use Firefox just because I want to keep them around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what? So, by the way, I feel the same way. I don't know. Do we mention Firefox? So we don't really have Firefox in the notes. So why not talk about Firefox? So Firefox had a second round of layoffs. They're going to move forward. This is a much smaller company. Their usage share in the browser market is going downhill dramatically. I think they're in the 3% range, right? I mean, they were at 10-15% for a long time. And that's bad. I mean, Firefox and Mozilla are good for the web. I really like this company and its ideals. But the thing is, you know, every time I install Firefox, I'm like, right, this is why I don't use Firefox. Like it's the only major browser that doesn't, well, I guess Safari doesn't do this either, but that doesn't support like this notion of installing web apps as standalone apps on the computer. Like this is such a normal modern thing to do. it seems like they should have been. Well, by the way, they were at the forefront of this at one point. Remember, there was a. I don't remember. They actually had this capability a long
time
ago.
They don't support PWA?
No, they support it in the browser, but it's in a browser tab. You can't have a standalone window that looks like the rest of the operating system. It's the only one that doesn't do it on Windows. And I think if it weren't for that, I would be happy to use Firefox, assuming the performance and stuff wasn't, you know, off the wall terrible. But I feel bad for them. I think their stance, I get it, but I they're going to get left behind. I mean, with the whole world basically going to Chromium except for Apple. I just feel like, I don't know, their days are kind of numbered.
That's sad. A monoculture in browsers is a very bad.
Yeah.
It is.
I'm not going to remember the year or the amount of money, but I saw a story in my news feed a week or so ago about Real Networks, right? There's the guys that made Real Audio and Real Player and all that stuff. And they sued Microsoft. They had an antitrust thing with Microsoft. They were part of the U.S. antitrust stuff. And in some year, 10 years ago, sometime, I don't remember when, they settled. And Microsoft gave them some hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't remember what it was. This is literally the only reason that company still exists. And God knows what they're doing with it. I don't know what they do. I don't care. But they still exist because Microsoft was forced to bail them out of the settlement. Yeah. I have this really bad feeling that's going to be Mozilla. You know, like 5 years from now, they'll still be kicking around. No one's using their browser. They have 0% browser, like user share on mobile, by the way, like zero. And they have 3% on desktop. Like in any other market, we wouldn't even be discussing this company. You know, it's just that they have such a rich heritage that dates back to Netscape. They're important. And honestly, like I said, I really care about what they're trying to do for the web. I just feel like this is going to end badly and I feel bad. But Google extended their default search agreement, and I don't remember the number, but they're getting hundreds of millions of dollars a year for the next 5 years. So that's going to cover their payroll and their insurance and their expenses and their building, whatever it is. And they'll be around. They're going to survive.
Yeah, that's what they've been living on all along. So it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. It's a good thing. But
if nobody uses it, it's going to, if they can afford to survive, if nobody uses it, then no websites will make an effort to support it. Then it will increasingly become a less desirable browser.
Yes,
and so so basically you come down to WebKit and Chromium derivatives.
Yeah, so years ago, a year and a half ago, whenever it was that Microsoft announced the move to Chromium, I had written something where I said, this is going to be the end of Firefox. Like because they came out against that so strongly.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, you know, this kind of attitude is what's going to doom this company. And I'll say now, my guess is that the day you know this company is dead is the day they finally announce, okay, we're going to support, we're going to do Chromium. And then, who cares? It's too late. It's too bad. I really, really feel bad for the company. Like I wish they were not just surviving but thriving.
Why do you
but
think
they're not?
People aren't using it? Is it? It's not PWAs. Nobody even knows about that.
No,
that's just why you're not using PWAs. It.
Right? Yeah. No, it's not.
I mean, Chrome is still gaining share right now. Right? Even with Credge out there, like it's still continuing to gain share. So.
Yep.
I don't know. It's like, is there really any need for more? I understand the whole idea of why you want multiple browsers that are not all based on the same code, but if nobody uses it.
Right. So I think the biggest success of Chrome is that on desktop, at least, and I think it's still, even on the iPhone, it's probably the most used browser. It's amazing because it's not the default, you know, I mean, obviously it is on Android. And maybe the success of Android has caused people to say, well, I got this thing on my phone. I should use it on my desktop or whatever. But long before Android was the de facto standard, whatever, I mean, Google had established Chrome as the browser that everyone knew. It was the one thing, even people who don't go out in the world and look for software, and they're like, okay, job one, install Chrome.
Yep.
And then they move on. Yeah, like everyone does it. Your mother probably would know to do it at normal people, you know?
Yeah.
And I can't quite explain it, but it's... it's a great success on their part. I don't know how they did it. But that used to be Firefox, you know, before Chrome came around. At that time, IE was probably still kind of dominant when Chrome arrived. But, you know, Firefox was shooting up at the time, too. And Chrome appeared and Safari. I don't remember the timing of these things. But, today it's just all Chrome.
Yep.
Yeah, I use Firefox on almost everything, but
yeah, even on mobile.
Yeah, when I, well, not on Apple. Although with Apple, there's a Firefox on iOS. There's a Firefox thing called Focus that is ad blocking and all that stuff. And you actually, I keep it installed, you know, because as you know, on Apple. Yeah. Soon, but right now we can't change our default browser.
Yep.
Right. But with Focus, you can make that be your. Apple has a system for adding a Safari content blocker, so you can make that your content blocker. So, but even if you use Focus on iOS, you're using WebKit. That's the problem. Is there is no non WebKit browser on iOS? That's just that's not allowed.
To me, that should have informed Firefox or Mozilla that this is the right approach on other platforms as well. Like, you don't need to have rendering engine like Microsoft discovered a couple of years ago is just an excuse for lots of engineers, lots of work, and you're always trying to catch up. You know?
Yep. I guess, but it, do you really? I guess is that a, does that count as a monoculture if you have one kind of rendering engine? Or two?
Yeah, but it's where you should have a monoculture, because this is a place where the important thing is application compatibility. You know, standards, that web developers only have to write one version of something and it just works everywhere. That ensures it. You know, what you don't want is a situation like we had on the desktop where there is Windows, Linux, and the Mac. Oh. And if you want a native app to run on all three of those things, you have three different apps.
Yeah, and web developers hated this, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. You know, very.
So they weren't even testing the old Edge.
Yeah, because they couldn't. It's
they weren't even trying it.
Too much work.
I mean, look, we all miss the days of this site was optimized for IE whatever or Netscape whatever, you know. But that was never going to work. You know, not long term. Anyway, I think Firefox could put their innovations on top of the Chromium renderer and be a great browser. You know, and just put you could refocus the money you have to things that are important. Do what Brave has done and make it a privacy thing, you know, except from a brand you know about and trust. I think it's too late. It doesn't matter. But I get the decision, but I think they made a mistake.
Hey, good news. Panos Panay is joining the board of Sonos.
Yeah, good news.
Huh?
I don't know what to say about this. This is when you're rich and connected and powerful, you this is what you do. So I guess this is
join a lot
one
of boards.
The many. Yeah. So like this is his I made it moment, you know.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know.
I mean, you don't interpret it as like Microsoft and Sonos partnering more closely because of this. No, me neither. Yeah.
No.
I saw someone say, Sonos making foldable speakers.
Yes. It's the thinnest speaker we've ever made.
You know, when the speaker divides into two speakers, it really sparks creativity. Yeah. Science shows
it. Sounds so much better when there's a hinge.
Yeah. Yep. No, I don't think this is.
No. It's just a job. It's a nice, you know, 100K payday. Yeah. And,
yeah, you get some stock.
I honestly feel like Sonos is history. I will never buy another Sonos product.
Really?
Oh, God, no.
Yeah.
They screwed the pooch. And the thing that was their secret sauce, the ability to do multi-room playback, everybody does now.
Mm.
Yeah.
So they have no secret sauce. They basically make an IoT speaker, which obsoletes. I now, because I have two different generations of Sonos in my house, have to have two different Sonos apps. Mm. They don't talk to each other.
Mm.
It's incredibly annoying, and I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars because it is not cheap. No, Sonos won't be around in 2 years.
So, so Sonos has this temporary thing where the Google ecosystem, for the most part, and the Amazon ecosystem, for the most part, are kind of lower-end speakers, but that's obviously going to change, right? I mean,
it doesn't have to be. I can attach a Chromecast to my stereo.
Yeah.
Well, but they don't even technically make Chromecasts audio anymore, so that's kind of goofy. I don't understand why
Google did that. Do their TV Chromecast. Actually, what I have is a NVIDIA Shield, which is an Android TV on my big stereo.
Which is
I can say to my Google Home, play music on my Shield. I could say, well, the one thing they don't really push much, and they really ought to, is having using a Google or a Amazon interface device plugged into a better speaker system.
Right.
But they
right.
can't. You can do that. And I think as more people realize that, that's how it yep. should be. The IoT thing should be separated from the speaker system, because a speaker system never becomes obsolete, just the IoT thing. And that's where Sonos blew it.
So this is like the argument about an all-in-one computer. It's like, what happens when the screen goes south and you still have a fully working computer in the background? Right. I always sort of figured Sonos would get bought by Apple. I'm still kind of confused that never happened. You know, that system seems like it would be great for them. And by the way, that's the Sonos system. The one thing it is compatible with broadly is AirPlay 2.
Right.
You know?
Right. You also, I mean, Sonos only supports internet radio that it supports. So I subscribe to a very nice classical music service called Prime Phonic. Not supported.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yep. Same thing with podcast apps.
If I had
a choice, I would use Google Podcasts. I like that app.
Right.
It's not compatible.
Right.
The other problem is some apps can control Sonos and some can't. So, like one thing I liked about Google Play Music, this is true of Spotify as well, probably a few others. You could use that app and cast to Sonos. It was really nice because you get used to, like, if you use Spotify, let's say, that's the app you understand. You use it, like, you get it. So, just being able to play those speakers is nice. But if you have like a different music service, like I use YouTube Music now, I have to go into the Sonos app to play the music from YouTube Music. So, I kind of manage my music in one app, but then when I want to play through the speakers, I have to use this other app. And the other app, is terrible. Well, comparatively terrible. You know, it doesn't do everything. It doesn't let you mix and match songs on the fly without going into a special edit mode, you know, which is just a pain in the ass. So, yeah, it's the least of my problems in 2020, but the Sonos thing is on the list for sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, Panos, I'm sure he'll fix it. He's a product guy.
He will. He fixes everything. Mr. Fix-It.
First Zoom meeting they have, he'll be like, what do you guys think about adding Cortana support? And then they'll all laugh.
You guys heard about Teams? Why are we using Zoom?
Yeah. Hey, how come we don't have a Teams display?
I did watch, finally, Panos Panay.
Yeah.
Attempting to do it live, which I was impressed. Yeah. Having done it for a few years, it was really, I remember going back to the screensavers days where you'd have to say, well, now am I getting glare on this?
Yes.
Oh, crap, that's my phone number and things like that. Yeah. He did quite good, quite well, although it made me wonder why they didn't just get him a nice little stand.
Right.
It made me wonder why they didn't broadcast that thing. Live? Publicly.
Well, and that's the other thing. The day later they put it on, or, you know, a couple of days later they put it on YouTube. I don't understand why they're...
Well, they did edit it.
Did they?
They changed some of the screens. Did.
That's why.
Fake news.
But still.
Fake news.
Really?
What screens did they change? Why did they change them?
I think there was one that showed... what did it show? I saw somebody showing this. It was something from Epic, and yeah, it was like, some reason they didn't want to show it.
Stay away from the Epic stuff.
I know. I was like, whatever. It wasn't anything major. The one thing that's not in that press blog is there was another whole half hour of him answering press questions, and they did not include that. But you know what? They could have. There was nothing crazy in the press questions or any crazy answers. It was very...
Well, they'd have to get permissions from those people, I think.
Well, they didn't say anybody's name. They didn't say, you know, like, Mary Jo Foley wants to know, blah, blah, blah.
That was a dumb question, Mary Jo, but I'll answer it.
We'll answer it anyway, even though we like to pretend she doesn't exist. Yeah. Okay. No.
Yes, it runs Notepad.
Yes, it does. It runs it really well. Can we see Notepad on two screens? All right, Mary Jo, stop asking questions. No, so yeah, I mean, you got the gist of it. I thought I actually liked the presentation that they did for the press because I felt like it was less overproduced.
Yeah.
Right?
But
it was just like, here's
Was
Panos.
There a moment where he kind of said, this is why it makes sense?
No.
Was there that moment? I don't feel like there was.
I don't feel like they made the case. I don't. But you know what? That's why I think this is just me talking, but this is why I think they ceded so many devices to Microsoft corporate VPs, and they kept like putting little teasers out. I think they were just saying to them, okay, figure out how we should pitch this thing and why it's really great. You know,
I probably said this last week, but I think it's important to remember that this was what happened with the HoloLens. When the HoloLens came out, the big thing was, well, yeah, I mean, you showed us a couple of demos of things that, you know, whatever. Some of them were games, right? But what's the point of this thing? And they really didn't have an answer for that either. And then over the next year or so, some vertical markets emerged as needing this device, frankly, you know, and good partners and stuff. And so by the time HoloLens 2 happened last year, it seemed to make a lot more sense than it did originally. Yeah. So, you know, it's possible, you know, but I think the problem is, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think as people use it, more kind of use cases will come up, like the ways they hadn't even thought about people using it will start showing up.
Yeah, right.
Because right now the cases are very rudimentary, right? Like the woman who's cooking and wants to make dinner, she drags her list of ingredients from left screen to right screen and puts them in her to-do app so she can use it as a shopping list. Okay. I'm like, there's got to be better examples of what you can do around food prep and cooking than that, to me.
Yeah. Right? I also, I was going over this with somebody on Twitter, I think, and it was, you know, I have this phrase like optimize for the everyday, you know, and, obviously when you have two screens and you can run two apps side by side, there are certain things that are easier, right? Of course. I mean, it's obvious.
Yeah.
The question is, in day-to-day use in a device that fits in your pocket, a device we now think of as a phone, right? Are those instances more common or so important that a dual screen device becomes, you know, necessary. Required?
Yeah.
Necessary. That it outweighs the things that people turn to their phone to today, right? So I think if you look at like smartphones today, how they're marketed to consumers, like the number one thing by far is like the camera. There's no doubt about it. Yep. This is the single biggest concern, you know, and the camera on this thing is nothing special, nothing special at all.
The thing they you know what they have to do? They have to make people not call this or think of it as a phone. They have to do that. They have to succeed in doing that. And the problem is they keep undermining themselves because they keep showing it being used as a phone. And it's great. It can be used as a phone, right? But every time you show that as one of the marquee examples, you get compared to phones, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what they need to show this, every time they show it in a marketing video or on TV, wherever they're going to advertise and market this, they have to show it not as a phone. Right.
So
they have to.
If history is any guide, you know, with Surface Pro, the Surface tablet form factor.
Yeah.
In the beginning, they were very adamant that this thing was not a laptop, right? It was more versatile than a laptop. But if you look at the way they market it today for the past couple of years, it's literally called a laptop. It's not a laptop, but they call it a laptop. Right. And so I guess one could make the argument that if this thing succeeds 2 to 3 generations from now, it will be called a phone. And the way they'll market it is, We redefined what the phone was. We redefined the expectations that people have when they think the word phone or smartphone or however you want to say it. You know? I mean, because ultimately, like, yeah.
I think they need a different word.
Yeah. No,
I think they need to, like, come up with something like, you know how two-in-ones are called two-in-ones? They need an equivalent term for what this thing is to me.
Well, maybe that is the term. It's a two in one. You know,
mini convertible. 2-in-1.
A pocketable convertible.
Something like that, right? Because, if you're going head to head with iPhone or a Samsung phone or any phone, it's not gonna be as good as that. If you're looking for the camera and the phone, right?
Yeah. When Samsung came out with the original Note. The word phablet emerged, but I don't think Samsung invented this term. I don't think Samsung ever referred to the Note as a phablet. I think somebody in the press or something probably coined that term. I don't remember how it came about, but at the time it was a good word because it differentiated that device from other phones. Now today, we don't really do that. We don't really, you know, that term's kind of gone away. Most phones, not all phones, but most phones today do have really big screens.
Yeah, right. But we don't call them phablets, right?
I don't really hear that term anymore. So maybe, you know, maybe a term like phablet that would temporarily convey the difference.
How about a slablet? you know, Surface Fablet. Slablet? Right. No. You could see them in the launch video trying to come up with things that were unique. You know how they kept showing the groups of two apps? I forget what they called those. Two apps paired together, right? They're like, look at this. You can make these groupings of two apps that always come up together when you want them to be side by side. And I'm like, I don't know. Is that a feature?
You know, I don't know. Last Friday, probably, maybe Saturday, probably Friday, we were going to go out to eat, my wife and I. And I just posted something. We got to the restaurant because of the pandemic thing. There's like very limited seating. Yeah. And we had 15 minutes, so we're sitting in the car. So I checked, I popped out my phone, I looked at my email, and someone said, hey, you have a typo in this thing. Now, so this is not, but I can go to my website, I can sign in, I can go to the WordPress-based, you know, admin console. I can navigate through the thing, I can find it. I can actually edit it. I mean, it's terrible, but I can edit a document, and I made a change.
Yep.
And it worked, you know? The question is, you know, would that be better if I had like a Duo because of the screen size and everything? And the answer is absolutely, it would have been better.
Of course.
But again, this kind of goes to my point though. Like that doesn't happen that much, right? If that happened that much, I would keep a laptop in the car just in case, you know, but it doesn't happen that much. And I was glad to be able to fix it. Right. Cause you want to fix things like that, but, and it would have been better on a Duo for sure. But do I spend $1,400 on a Duo because that type of thing would have been easier, even though some of the other things that I use on my phone every single day, taking pictures and posting them to Instagram or whatever, which matter to me, would be worse.
Yeah. I know.
I keep coming back to that same, you know, it's the same thing over and over again, really.
One of my friends in New York who knows I cover technology, as soon as the Duo was announced, sent me an email and he said, are you going to get one of those Duo things? I'm like, yeah. I said, are you interested in it? And he said, I already have the use case. And I'm like, what's the use case? I'm really curious. And he said, I like to play poker and I like to bet on horses. So I'm going to have poker on one side and horses on the other side and I can do it at the same time. And I'm like,
You see? We knew
Maybe you'll be in the commercial.
I know. I was like, okay, well, that's a very unique and very specific and custom use case.
There is a point to be made there, which is until we get this and people use it, we don't know what the use case is. I think of the Apple Watch, which at first really seemed dopey. But
remember, the Apple Watch became something very different in V2.
As they added feature, and that's the real, I understand what your point is, which is that this is V1 of something brand new. Yeah. And so clearly it's not going to live up to all of its promise.
You're right.
But the Apple Watch was an example of something that every different user has a different kind of there's no one thing it does.
Yeah.
And I can see myself using the Duo in a variety of interesting ways, but you know, we won't know till we get it.
We won't.
So to further the Apple example, remember Apple used to have these ads on TV. This is probably 25 years ago, but it was like, what's on your PowerBook? Remember, they'd have people would show you the stuff they had.
I loved those ads, actually.
Well, what's on your Duo, right? Yeah. And what it could be is the unique combination of these two apps side by side that makes terrific sense for that particular person. You know, and you could go through a long list of people, because for some people it will be entertainment related. For your friend there who has a gambling problem, it's something terrible. you know, some people it's going to be productivity stuff. You know, I'm a student and I'm taking notes, and maybe there's a transcript of the class occurring on the other screen or whatever.
For me, left hand is notepad. No, probably right hand is notepad, and left hand is our CMS system, so I can cut and paste. Boom, right.
Well, yeah. See, I think that would be better on a Neo class device, but
it would. But I mean, we don't have a Neo, and we don't know when we'll get one. So,
but you have a laptop, Mary Jo.
I know, but you know what? You don't, like you said, you don't always want to carry your laptop around, even if it's in your car, right? Like it'll be, if this will work for those kind of emergency situations. The one thing I need for this to truly be a productivity device for me is that overlay keyboard that they showed with the Surface Neo, because typing on glass for anything more than a couple lines is not really great for me. I know there are people who can do it. It's not for me.
I've witnessed people typing away on an iPad screen. It kind of blows my mind, but Yeah. It's certainly possible. I mean, I could never.
It is.
It's too big, but I mean.
But if they have the little cool case for the Duo that had that little fun keyboard that you could use, I'd be like, all right, now we're getting there.
Yeah.
Right.
We'll see.
So yeah, I did end up buying one because I am worried they're not going to send me a review unit, and I'm like, you know what, I should just buy one, and I can always return it in 60. You have 60 days to return it. And the reason I couldn't get it to go through, this is a word to the wise here, if you've had problems trying to get the order to go through, the reason it wouldn't go through was I also ordered a SIM card for it, an AT&T SIM card, which was free. But on the Microsoft Store, I guess you can't order something that's free that's not from Microsoft. And so it kept breaking up my order. And finally, they called me and they're like, we see what you're trying to order. So we're going to charge you $2 for the SIM card, and then we're going to give you the $2 back, and then your order will go through.
That's crazy.
All right. I'm like, okay. I was so trying for hours. I was just like,
whatever. Are you going to sign up for an AT&T, a data account or something? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
Because you're on Verizon, aren't you?
I'm on Verizon, but I don't want to use my Verizon SIM in it because I want to keep using my phone.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you have a month-to-month plan you can do on AT&T that will give you data?
I'm thinking they have one. I know. No, yeah. I'm not going to subscribe for you.
They probably do.
Yeah, I know. I got a free AT&T SIM just in case I can do that. I was thinking I could do a month-to-month thing and just have it as my trial account, you know?
Yep.
Okay. Hopefully. I don't think I can use my Google Fi SIM in there, right? No.
you definitely could.
I could.
You could use it as a data. Oh. Yeah, you absolutely could. Yep.
Oh, then that's what I'll do. I'll just use my Google Fi SIM.
Yeah,
it would connect Surface to T-Mobile
only. Yeah, but it would work fine. Okay. I've done that. I've done that in phones. Just use it as a data SIM, yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay, that's what I'll do then. Yeah.
You can also, by the way, order a data SIM. It's just data.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Google I could have done Fi. That too.
It's free, but you should just order it today.
I am sitting.
I can do it from Verizon, right?
Yeah. Everybody sells it.
But just do it from, I mean, just
Google Fi is the best deal. Because
I have my Google Fi already.
Yeah, it's only
too.
You can order an extra data SIM for free, and then you only pay when you use data. So
that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. That's what I did. I actually have a second SIM.
Yeah, that works fine.
I am sitting on a SIM right now waiting for my Duo.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah. It won't do all of the. I would just get a regular SIM, then you can make phone calls. Stuff.
But it will. But you don't.
I know. I kind of want to try the phone too.
No, get the regular SIM. It's makes no difference.
You can do that too. Yeah, just test it. I mean, put your Fi SIM in it. Use because you have a separate phone number for that, obviously. Yeah, just do it.
I do.
You'd have to get a. Yeah, that's the.
You'll pay for it. You know, you'll pay for it that month. You'll pay for the.
Yeah.
Whatever the base fee, $15-$20.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Okay. Yep.
There you go. See.
Yeah. Problem solved. Yeah.
What's our next caller, Leo? Who else do we have today?
we have Joe TikTok on the line. I love it. It's so clear at this point that Trump is completely puppet mastering this TikTok thing. Because now you've got Oracle in the mix. Yeah. And there's no question because Larry Ellison is a Trump supporter at fundraisers for him that the president called him up and said, hey, Larry, wouldn't you like to own TikTok?
I think Oracle is ideal because they have the morality and the intestinal fortitude necessary.
You know they won't ruin TikTok.
It will slot in right between their database products. And what the hell does this company even make? Who cares? Java.
Yes.
Other things Oracle has ruined. .com.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. I just want
you got to wonder. Okay.
Is completely at the behest of the president. No question in my mind.
But okay, put your Larry Ellison hat on, and if you were, you know,
try not to
told, hey, why don't you
mistakes.
Why don't you say you're bidding on TikTok too? If you were trying to make a case, why would we Oracle want TikTok? Could you even make the case? Why? Terms of them being the hoster of the data, right? Because, you know, they just got Zoom earlier this year to agree to host some of their data in Oracle's cloud. So reportedly they did that by undercutting everybody else's price. So they don't care about how much it costs them to do it. It's a marquee account, right? And you're like, hey, we host Zoom and we host TikTok. So look at our cloud.
I think the Oracle is the Oldsmobile of the tech world, or at least they should be because Oldsmobile's not around anymore. But Oracle buying this company, or you know, whatever parts of this company. I think it's like U.S., Canada, Australia, and
the same ones Microsoft originally said they were going to buy.
I think would trigger a mass exodus away from the service, and it would devalue it immediately. So I hope they do it because you could spend up to $15 billion. They don't. I think they have $43 billion in cash and other assets, so they're going to need an outside investor to make the purchase. So they get rid of all the cash, and then buy a product that dies overnight. I think it's the perfect outcome for this. So I support Oracle buying TikTok. In fact, I'd like to make a bumper sticker to that effect to put it on my car. I hope it's what happens.
Well, the other reason, Ellison.
I'm on Team Oracle.
Team Ellison.
Team Ellison.
Now, if you're on Team Ellison, the other reason you want to do this is you make Microsoft pay more money for it, right?
Oh, so, that's really what's going on. I didn't even think of that. Of course.
Yeah.
So do you think,
I mean, Larry
think
Ellison,
true?
He's,
think
he's
really
the evil genius.
It's the old Salesforce play. I get
it. He is the evil genius. Like, he's sitting there going, how can I mess with Microsoft? Let's see. Let's throw your hat into the ring on TikTok and tell them you're going to pay $30 billion, so they have to pay $35
billion. Mm. That can backfire, though. Sometimes you hold up that paddle one too many times.
It can.
Yeah.
It can.
I don't see Larry Ellison ever getting the last laugh against Microsoft, frankly. But, I mean,
He's going to try.
He's going to try. Yeah. He tried to mess up Jedi from Microsoft, right? He was in there bidding on it, and then the government was like,
he spent his entire career doing stuff like this. He tried to get Steve Jobs back at Apple when Gil Emilio was running the show, and
He is Mr. Burns. Isn't he?
He is Mr. Burns.
Excellent.
Right, right. And most people are like, why is he rich again? What is he?
Why is he rich? And he's very rich, by the way. He's not just rich.
I'm pretty sure he's only alive now because he feeds off the blood of children. I don't understand this guy is a thing.
Trace comma rich.
No, people still buy Oracle databases, and they pay Oracle a lot of money to maintain for maintenance plans on their database.
Is it a better enterprise database? I mean, is that the case?
Is that still the case?
So it depends who you ask, right? Like, it's one of those things that people have had them for so long. It's like you've had an Oracle database for so long, you're just going to keep it going.
That I understand. Yeah, legacy, I understand.
We have like an oil thing in the cellar, so like we just keep getting oil. But
at some point, Paul, the burner ran out again.
Yeah.
Got to call the oil company.
Attach a dirty hose from a truck to the side of the house. Pump the house full of some flame explosive liquid.
I used to have an oil burner heater in Connecticut. Once I let the oil run low, it blew soot all over everything. Oh, my God. It was a nightmare. Yeah.
There are people out there who are in the younger generation who look at Microsoft and Oracle and say, I hope neither of them buy it because they both are enterprise companies who don't understand consumers. I hope Twitter gets it.
That's fair. And I actually think if life made any sense, Twitter can't afford TikTok. But they have the experience needed to make this thing fly. They're the only company that does. You know, Microsoft has consumer experience, but not expertise.
I know. No, the people who are pulling the strings on this, and you can kind of guess who are all the sources on all these leaks about this stuff. It's the analysts, right? I mean, it's the venture capitalists like Sequoia, who also have a stake in TikTok, who are talking to everybody about this, right?
Oh, and that's interesting. Yeah.
I think that's who's telling people who's bidding.
Company would trying to get these. Because they could be on both sides of the transaction because they would need to help Oracle buy it. And it's like a real estate.
And they'd have to help Microsoft buy it too, or they'd be involved in that transaction too, right?
Yeah. I was really wrong. I said last week that Microsoft would drop their bid completely. Like
I know,
potato.
And we told you no.
Wrong. Yeah, you were right.
Oh, I still want you to be right about that. It could still happen.
We both do. We both do.
I don't. I wonder now if any sale will happen. I think this has really gotten ridiculous.
I know. Right. So now they have until what? What's the new date? It's not September 15th.
He changed it from 45 to 90 days.
Right.
The election is in 77 days.
Yeah.
So
after
maybe we just don't worry about this.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, remember, there's an interregnum between the election and inauguration of a couple of months.
Right.
Of wouldn't it be funny if he extended it till like January 21st? So either I'm going to be in complete charge by then, and or it won't matter.
Not going to care.
It just won't matter.
Yeah. Well, let's see who bids next week, because it's just every week we get new bidders.
Sears? Could Sears buy this thing?
Sears.
I mean, like, what? Someone on Twitter said something like Pepperidge Farms, you know?
Pepperidge Farms, TikTok.
Okay, yeah, the new deadline is November 12th.
November 12th, after the election. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, when is it? It's sometime in November. Yeah.
I've stopped trying to parse any of this stuff. It's just noise now.
It is at this
TikTok
point.
Should be a thing that none of us on this podcast should have ever cared about or thought about. It's something like we sort of understand is happening outside of our world, but it doesn't matter.
The fact I've already got TikTok pick of the week lined up, guys. I'm just telling you.
Actually, after Sunday's twit, Amy Webb convinced me I should not have TikTok on my phone. And then there's an op-ed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's an op-ed piece by Tim Wu in the New York Times today saying we should absolutely ban TikTok.
Right.
But I don't kind of agree with his premise, which is, well, the Chinese are doing it to us, so we should do it to them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's good
thinking.
That's good thinking. I'm just of the opinion that that's what we do. We are open and we stand up for openness.
Yeah.
And just because Turkey and China and Iran have a closed internet doesn't mean, oh, well, we got to retaliate. No, we should.
Yeah.
This is created is an open internet.
Arguing that the internet that we pretend exists doesn't exist and that it's going to be closed. It's always closed. And I'm sorry, but that's literally not the point of the internet.
Right.
Right.
And I think it's appropriate for us as a free nation to stand up for a free internet. And just because some regime is closing it down. Now, and I just don't think it's appropriate to say, well, it's Chinese, so we don't want it.
Well, is that the level you want to aspire to? We want to be just like Turkey, North Korea, and China?
We don't.
Or Iran or whatever. Right. That's crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
But anyway, I thought it was an interesting op-ed. I was surprised because Tim's pretty smart. But I just thought, this doesn't seem right to me.
Well, I think, you know, something about TikTok that has really cranked the crazy valve in people. And if the government wants to ban it or military or whatever, that's absolutely fine.
Completely
no
fine.
Problem.
And they should.
No problem.
And if Wells Fargo bans it, which they did, fine.
Yep. Absolutely.
If I should decide, no Twit employee should have TikTok on their company phone.
We don't want it on our corporate network. Absolutely not a problem. Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's an appropriate reaction. The United States of America should not be banning apps.
Banning it is one thing. We're going to separate this company somehow and give it to someone else. Like, what are you talking? It's not based in the United States. Like, it's unbelievable. It's no wonder the world hates us. It's no wonder.
Amy's point, and so this is a personal decision. I took TikTok off.
Yeah. What was her point for you as a person not to use TikTok?
Her point is, many have said this, including Ben Thompson on Stratechery, is that China's goal really is economic hegemony, and that TikTok is a very important tool in that. She said ByteDance is not a social media company. It's an artificial intelligence company. They were involved in creating the social credit scoring system in China. They are using this to gather information. I don't care if China knows what books are on my bookshelf. Mm. And by the way, I never use TikTok to create. It's a passive viewing thing. So I'm not too worried about what information it might gather. More to me, what is concerned is how it might use TikTok in the same way that, by the way, Facebook is being weaponized to slant the content in such a way to spread misinformation and so forth.
Yep.
And Facebook, you know, there was just a study came out that shows that Facebook is probably not actively, but their algorithm is surfacing misinformation about COVID far more than is surfacing reliable information about COVID.
That's weird because I actually go to Facebook for my COVID information.
You're smart enough not to. I know you're joking.
You're smart enough not to, but
let me tell you, the people that I follow on Facebook are geniuses, and they have all the best ideas.
This was, I read this on The Guardian. This, we'll talk about it later on Twig, I'm sure. This is a story, a study. Mm-hmm. Who is it from? I'm looking at the article right now. Well, as an example, it was a report from Avaaz, A-V-A-A-Z. It said that Facebook found a global network of 82 sites spreading health misinformation over at least five countries used Facebook to generate 3.8 billion views over the last year. April, 460 million views in a single month. And so that's the problem, is that I don't think necessarily with Facebook's cooperation, but certainly without Facebook stopping it, is being weaponized against us. So right. I think TikTok could easily be weaponized in that kind of way by the Chinese government. So consider what you're consuming.
Could is like one of those.
Could doesn't mean they are.
Things. I mean, right.
I mean, that we already know that you can't talk about the Uyghur Muslims on there. You can't talk about Hong Kong on there. You know, they definitely are censoring it. There was evidence for a while that if you were overweight, they were blocking you. On my current TikTok feed, there are many overweight people, so that's obviously stopped.
Well, now they're considered humorous.
Now so it's just funny.
I've always kind of felt like when this thing's first started up, my take on TikTok, aside from the whole China angle, is like this just feels temporary to me. And, you know, obviously I could be wrong about anything, but I mean, I don't feel like TikTok has legs. Haven't we had several services that were short form videos that kind of came and went? I mean, I don't know.
Only reason I like it, and it's purely sentimental, is I just feel like it's become a great creative platform for a lot of people, mm-hmm. and they really are doing some really wonderful stuff. So I like seeing that.
But look, I can go to YouTube. I can watch a video of a fox hopping on a trampoline. It's fun. I don't need to go to TikTok.
It's true. And that's the point, is that American companies like Facebook and YouTube are definitely using the algorithm to slam.
Me.
Yeah, they're slanting stuff already.
Yes.
I don't know. I think it's appropriate for a personal decision. I took it off. That's fine. Appropriate for a company decision. It's just not appropriate for the U.S. government to ban TikTok, I don't think.
For the public, yeah. I mean, like, in government, in the military, no problem. Couldn't care less.
Yeah.
You know? Yep.
Yep. Moving right along. Actually, let's take a break, then we'll come back with the big Xbox news. I tell you what. Okay, just to make this fair, I'll give Mary Jo some Microsoft 365 time. I'll give you some Xbox time. They don't
That's
have to
be
equal.
That's not as fair as it sounds.
It's not. But we can pretend it's fair.
I'm just, you know, I don't care if it is fair. I just care that it sounds fair.
That's, okay, that you want the impression of fairness.
Yeah, that's my impression of fairness is all I need. Our show today brought to you by LastPass, which is all about not the impression of, but the reality of securing your business and your workforce. Right now, if you're a business, you're looking at a very interesting landscape out there, right? Employees have gone home, nothing to protect them. They're sitting in their house on their, personal internet, getting emails, logging in, chatting, all that stuff. When LastPass surveyed a bunch of global IT decision makers, they found that almost all, 96%, said their remote workforce has impacted their identity and access management strategy. Completely reasonably so. For instance, you know, employees like to share passwords. You know, you want to get into the bank account? Sure, let me send you that password. They'll text it or email it. At least in the office, they could write it on a note and hand it to another person. A little bit more secure. But if you have LastPass, as we have had now for more than 5 years, that changes everything. They can securely share passwords. You can give people access to company resources without even giving them the password. Single sign-on is more secure, but there's no password involved at all. LastPass is the way you can manage identities, promote good security behaviors, even if your employees are working from home. And you know,
maybe, you know, I know we'll be able to come back to work at some point. I hope sooner than later. But a lot of businesses, we're going to still have people working from home. We've discovered a new way of work, right? So this is for the long run. You need LastPass. You need LastPass at home, but you need LastPass at work. Of course, the keystone is secure password storage. Your employees get their own vault for sharing every app and web login they use. And man, what a vault. It's so secure. They're using AES 256 strong encryption. The vault is never decrypted anywhere but on device. And the master password used to decrypt it is never transmitted anywhere. Not to LastPass. No, they don't have access to it. No one does. Just you. And that's so important. I trust LastPass so much. It's on everything, iOS, Android, Mac, Windows, Linux, everywhere I go, every browser. And I use it as a secure, basically my secure enclave. It is the one place I can put things like my social security numbers for my whole family, my passport, driver's license, all that stuff that you really need to keep secure. But it's always available, and I love that. It makes it better and safer to share passwords. It captures and fills every credential capture. So when you create a new credential, it says, you want to remember that? You say yes. And then when you go back there, it fills it in automatically for you. So your workflow is never disrupted. Employees love that. LastPass is some sort of magic because we've always said it's a trade-off between convenience and security. Somehow LastPass is both more secure and more convenient. As your IT department gets complete centralized control, you have policies you can enforce. We enforce, for instance, two-factor authentication on all master passwords. Every employee has to do two-factor. We also have minimum password requirements, so they have to use good, strong passwords. And you get actionable insights into employee password behavior from your admin dashboard. You know exactly who's using what, where, when. That's so important. User management is much simplified. It's very easy to add or remove users. You can even automate it with directory integration. And employees always have their passwords. So there's no more phone calls. I can't get in, you know. When employers are using LastPass, user identities are centrally and securely managed. And that means you can ensure the correct employee is doing the right thing at the right time. They have the access they need, not more than or less than. And they work more efficiently. I think you should be using LastPass. Have I made the case? Go check it out. LastPass.com/twit. At home, at the office, in a family, LastPass is the only way to go. LastPass.com/twit. Let your remote workforce focus on the work without compromising your business's security. Secure that remote workforce with LastPass. LastPass.com/twit. All right. The impression of fairness.
And the reality of incredible unfairness.
Well, I think Mary Jo could go on for hours about Microsoft 365.
I could, too.
Except
the problem is...
What?
That story is Paul's story.
Oh, I tried, Mary Jo.
I know. I actually want to hear about this because I'm curious about these Teams displays.
I can send you one. I got two of them.
What is it?
Do you like them?
It's a physical display?
Yeah. So if you're familiar with the Lenovo smart displays that run on the Google Assistant, they are making one called the Think Smart that looks exactly like those, is the smaller 8-inch size. But it's black like a ThinkPad.
Do you have it right there?
And it's what's called a Microsoft Teams display. What's that?
Do you have it right there?
Yeah. I don't know if I don't want to make it.
It looks just like the Lenovo. It even has that little tilty thing. So it is the Lenovo display, but with Teams now.
That's right.
Is it still Google?
Yeah. So it's a Snapdragon something, five or 600 series processor. It's AOSP based. Which is kind of interesting. You know, if you bring up like the virtual keyboard, you'll recognize it as the old fashioned stock Android keyboard. Right now it only has three experience. Oh, I should say. So Microsoft announced this sometime over the summer that these things were coming and that the Lenovo would be the first. And the way they described it at the time, it didn't make any sense to me, because if you think about what a smart display is in a smart home or in a home, right, it's a group device. It's for everybody. And, you know, anyone can walk into the kitchen and say, hey, G, play this playlist or whatever. And it just plays it, right? It can recognize different voices and have different profiles and do things like that. It's meant to be in a common area. But these smart displays, these team displays, are meant to be used by an individual for the most part, although there's kind of a guest mode. Most part is an individual device. It's meant to be used next to a computer. And then you think, well, why would you need such a thing? And it's actually a little bit like the Duo thing where two screens are better than one. The idea is you're using this for the video meetings for the most part, calls, we'll call them calls, and you're using your computer for what it's good for. So you're working on a presentation or a document, you want to call someone and discuss it. You can both have your computer be free for the computer stuff, but the screen is used just for the the Teams related stuff. So, okay, you know, the first version is super limited. Literally, it has the calling capability, and you can access your calendar and your voicemail. That's the whole thing.
Oh, so there's no voice assistant built into it?
No, it's not. It's okay. Even though it looks the same, it has a completely different point, I guess, is the way to say it. So okay. I was kind of surprised by how little it does. I mean, there's very little going on. There is a mode, it's called Hot Desk, and the idea there is that other people could sign into it and access their stuff at that point. You know, I don't think we're ever going to be in an – well, short term, we're not going to be in an office with other people, so it's not really a big deal. But there are things coming in the future, and I'll just read them because I there's no way I would remember this. But Cortana voice skills, U.S. English only, an ambient screen mode with your most recent chats and alerts and messages, smart replies, notes and messages, the ability to configure the wallpaper, Teams chat, and I assume by Teams chat they mean text-based chat, but why would you want to do that on this device? It's so terrible. Mm. And then access to SharePoint-based files. So that way you would just be using a single screen for everything, I guess, at that point. So the issue with this is it's a small device, and that's okay. 8 inches, it's fine. But it's got that Dell, the old Dell XPS 13 up the nose effect because, you know, the thing's down on the desk. Below you, so you get this like unflattering up, you know, up the chin, up the nose kind of view. It works fine. I mean, I used it in a call with Brad, maybe on Monday or whatever day that was. And the quality is decent. I guess it's Snapdragon 624. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Who is it for? Right. Like the question is who would this be for?
Yeah. And yeah, right. I don't know.
I mean, maybe it's for people who have to be on a meeting. They don't really have to be paying attention, but they have to be there and they want to be using their main desktop to do work. And but they have to still like be there in the meeting.
Yep. So maybe. I don't know. Maybe there. Oh, look, it did flip around. Yeah. So it does work in portrait mode. I just noticed for the first time. Mm-hmm. I don't use my – we have a Lenovo smart display out in the kitchen. We love it. And it's pretty much just a smart photo frame, to be honest. But we do love it. This one,
it's funny because I just this morning, Google announced that they were going to support calls for Duo and Meet on their Nest Hub Max.
Right.
And I went, oh, that's great. And I just bought another one for my home office to put at the bottom of my Mac. So it'll be the Mac, and I think it'll fit right there.
It would be like what we're describing here.
Exactly what you're describing. Mm-hmm. But the difference is it does support Google Assistant. I mean, Cortana is not quite the same thing.
Well, but if you think, again, you got to put this in the context of...
This is a more full-featured thing, because like your Lenovo display, I get the pictures... I can at my calendar. It sees me, so it says, "Oh, hi, Leo. Here's your calendar." There's a lot of things you can do with it, including, by the way, multi-room music, Sonos style. So
and soon you can do Zoom calls.
Yeah, and I'll be able to. Yeah, Zoom's coming to it too. And I thought, no, of course I have a camera on my computer, and I could do it that way. But I thought, you know, it's right there. It's kind of an interesting idea. I want to play with it. It's $200. Mm-hmm. Put that right
I mean,
there.
Look, I'm trying to come up with ideas for this, but I think whether you're coming into an office or not, you could pick these things are managed for one thing, and they're managed through your Microsoft 365 account. I mean, I could picture an IT department deploying these things out to people and saying, "Look, don't worry about configuring and webcams and microphones. This is the device. Mm-hmm. Put it next to your laptop.
Yeah,
you can work in Word or PowerPoint or Excel or whatever, and this thing will be all the team stuff, right? And yeah. Okay. I guess maybe for me, honestly, and for many people, I don't think it's necessary. But it works. Yeah. I mean, it works.
Well, and the reason I like the Google ecosystem a little bit better, I can do voice messages. So I can say, hey, send a message to Paul saying I'm running a little late. And it was text actually with an audio message. Things like that are kind of handy.
That might be – there is a voicemail functionality.
It's like a little assistant on your desk.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Teams in a box.
Yeah. If you lived in Teams, this would be desirable. I could totally see how desirable that would be. Because, you know, I look at Lisa, who's working at home now. She lives in Zoom because that's kind of mostly what we use.
Yeah.
A little dedicated Zoom thing
right.
would actually kind of make sense.
So Zoom just semi-solved this problem by announcing support for all these different smart displays.
Facebook
right?
portal. And
Yeah. So if you guys have settled on the Google Nest or whatever, you could throw one in her office and it could be that device, you know?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And the nice thing in that case is when it's not being used, you'd have nice photos and stuff happening on it.
Yeah, and in my calendar, and I could do other things with it, and it just feels like it's, you know, I had this notion. It's my little assistant sitting. I don't know if the height's going to be quite right, but it's sitting below my Mac. I don't want it to block the Mac screen, but I don't. I wish it had a telescoping
webcam so that it could be.
Actually, you know what? I could put it on a little stand behind the screen.
Yeah, put it up on a speaker maybe if you have like speakers.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting – it becomes more and more like a virtual assistant on your desk.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you what I don't need here in my home office is more ways to talk to work.
Yeah.
I know.
I feel like we're good. I mean, it's on all my phones. Yeah. It's on my laptops. It's on the computer I'm using now, which actually is a laptop.
When you say work, do you mean – do you mean Brad Sams?
I mean Brad. the corporate
that
overlord.
That guy in the bunny suit.
You can talk to me anytime, Paul. I'm here for you, baby.
Well, I mean, we use Teams at work, so.
Of course.
I'm not going to use this to. I mean, I'm not going to use this thing to chat, which is kind of a problem, right? I mean, I don't know. Maybe there'll be functionality where you can use your computer keyboard and type onto that thing, but typing onto this screen, which is at some kind of a. A slight angle is not.
I hear China is making a TikTok screen. I think that'll be great. I'll put that right there. Can wave at Premier Xi anytime.
Dedicated TikTok.
I'm sorry. It's possible for chatting. What they'll do is a transcription thing, like you have on your phone, right? So maybe that wouldn't be horrible.
I'm really intrigued by this whole idea.
Yeah,
I think the idea Microsoft just wants to give you every option, right? Yeah. They want to give you Teams phones, Teams displays, Teams this, Teams that, whatever you, however you work, they want to have a device.
It's not like Lenovo doesn't have a bunch of these lying around.
Yeah.
Well,
let's put some Teams on that thing and sell more.
Yeah, help me get rid of these things. It's got a nice little ThinkPad style, you know, look to it. If you like that kind of black business class look, you know, it's. Mm-hmm. It's fine. The more I think about it, I guess, you know, for those people who look, we can't even buy webcams today, right? I mean, if you don't want to worry about people configuring Teams on their personal laptop because they're working from home, ship them one of these devices, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's nothing to do.
Yeah.
You just plug it in and connect it to Wi-Fi.
Actually.
And then it'll just work.
First line workers. I say that every show. First line workers, perfect group for this device.
Yeah. So actually, in that situation, so I have not tried that hot desk feature, but, actually, let me just see what it does when I do. Yeah, you have to sign in. So I don't know how this would. I don't know if it stores the sign-ins or if you have to keep, entering your password every time. But you could picture one of these. I mean, ideally, it would be doing like a face recognition thing, which this does not do. But ideally, if you could have one of these in a common space on a factory floor or whatever it is, and you could walk up to it, it signs you in, and then you could have that. You know, Bob wants you to call him back in the main office or whatever it is, kind of thing. Or check your schedule or whatever. Like, and then it's not on your personal device, right?
Right.
Yeah, I guess there's some point to it. I can't wait to send this thing back. I don't know.
Hey, you tried it out. Now you have the feel for what it is, right?
Well, so I'm going to hold on to it long enough to see the other stuff. I want to see when they start adding the features. Because right now it's, you know, it's pretty limited, but. Yeah, I'm curious to see how they upgrade it.
Mm-hmm. Now I want to ask Mary Jo to do the Xbox segment.
I can say one other thing in Microsoft 365.
Please.
No dev channel build for Windows 10 this week because they had some kind of a blocking bug they're saying maybe later in the week, but kind of hinting no build this week.
All right.
You could have milked that a little bit.
You know. I could have milked it a little longer. Talked about what could the breaking bug be.
Way too efficient.
Just blew right through that.
You know, actually, in the next segment, I am interested in Flight Simulator.
Are you?
I am.
In what way?
I'm not interested enough to buy an Xbox, but I think that game looks super cool.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah, it is beautiful looking for sure.
You know, it's a perfect game for you because there are long stretches of absolutely nothing to do in the game.
I think that's perfect.
Yeah.
You could have some music on and just get up and make some tea. A plane, right?
Yeah. Just take a nap. It's like we're flying this thing across the Atlantic for like 5 hours.
I don't even call it a game. It's more like a distraction almost, right?
Mary Jo will never use the slew mode. She'll just fly in real time the whole darn way.
I would. Day and night, all over the world. That would be me.
It is actually, you know, it's really cool, especially if you can
very soothing,
get enough screens, big screens. There's, as with all flight, there are moments of panic at takeoff and landing, and the rest of the time is very calm. Unless you get hit by a
bird. It's just like, so it's very realistic then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. But putting it on a PC, I know my PC is not adequate for this game.
Not your laptop,
obviously.
No.
Obviously.
Yeah. It would look like a Nintendo 64 or something, but
yeah.
It will eventually come to the Xbox, and so maybe that's when you could jump in.
I'm actually surprised to hear that Flight Sim was not on the PC. When did that happen?
It was not on the PC for many years. Yeah,
they took it off. Huh?
Yep.
In fact, for a long time, it was moribund. Just they weren't doing anything. Now they
For many years. Yep.
Yeah. It's part of the Xbox Game Pass, so that's cool.
Yeah.
Is it? Have you played it on the PC versus on the Xbox, Paul? Is it easier?
Well, it's not. It's not on the Xbox yet. So it's coming.
You need those. You need all the buttons
next year. Yeah, you want the yokes and the like the whole thing, I guess. But
yeah, it'd be weird playing it on a PC. Yeah,
a giant curved display, maybe.
You need a special chair. You need the pedals.
Yeah.
There are people.
You need someone to dress up as a flight attendant and bring you crackers and stuff.
Joystick.
You need a tray table. You do, so that you can feel cramped. And
you got inflatable autopilot. So they got the whole thing.
So sometime this fall, it's going to be available on the next generation HP VR headset. I've forgotten the name, unfortunately, but I believe I'm going to be testing that. So I think that's when I'm going to give this game a shot. I'm curious what that looks like in VR, because games like, if you've ever played like a first person shooter in VR, it's nauseating. But I feel like this game, because of the inherent slowness of the motion, might be a great example of something that works well in VR.
I wonder if it'll ever come to HoloLens. Will it ever?
I don't think so. No.
I'm like, no.
No. No.
No, because you don't want to see the room you're in. You want to, you know, in addition to.
Yeah, because you're right. Yeah.
You want to, this that literally, you want to, you want to block out everything. Yeah.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all I had to say about that. I just thought it looks really cool. And if I had a PC that it could work on, I would try it.
Yeah, you would. You could take off from LaGuardia. It's a quick jaunt.
Exactly.
Go up, fly.
Go around the Empire State Building a few times.
Yep. There's no flight.
So there are
restrictions. You can go anywhere.
There are many tips about places that are beautiful to look at in the game. And then there are the things that are sort of reminiscent of when Apple Maps first appeared and it was all wrong. You know, like apparently Buckingham Palace looks like a generic office building because they didn't.
Sad. Actually. Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. So look, I mean, you know, they can't map the entire planet, right? So, I mean, I assume there'll be improvements and all that kind of stuff. But some of the imagery I've seen from this game is absolutely stunning. It just looks beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Fly over the Grand Canyon, Mary Jo. It's only 6 hours away.
I know. That'd be pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been 37 years since Flight Sim was released.
Has it really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's 150 gigabytes. So you can't run it on your HP stream.
Your stream.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. You need 1909, Core i5, or Ryzen 3.
By the way, I thought you needed 2004 2004.
Jesus. It's I'm looking at PC Perspectives article. It says 1909.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but I thought
maybe they got it wrong. 8 gigs of RAM. You really want a GTX 770 or a Radeon RX 570. And you need 5 megabits because this thing is not solo, man. You got to have some internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, better the resolution and the frame rate, the more hardware you're going to need.
Yeah. By the way, though, if you have an Xbox Game Pass PC or Ultimate subscription, you just get it. You know, you don't even have to buy it.
Isn't that awesome?
When, though? Awesome. Not now.
It is 1909, by the way. Thanks, says it.
Okay.
When what?
When can you get it?
When is it on Xbox Game Pass?
No, it's available today. Right now.
Today.
Yep.
Oh, it already is? Oh.
It's only 150 gig download. You should have it by late
tomorrow. I know.
Tomorrow.
150 gigs, right? I know. I was like, what?
Yeah. Well, by the way,
I'm not
going to
be playing it.
That's become kind of common in the console world.
That's right. Even if you buy the disc.
The Master Chief Collection's like that. The new Call of Duty's like that.
Yep. It's a beast. It's tough. It's a big old beast. All right. Now, for reals, it's time for the Xbox segment.
Oh, the other Xbox stuff. So there is other Xbox stuff. No, that was nice.
It was nice.
Look at Mary Jo. Yeah. 2 weeks in a row that she contributed to the Xbox segment.
I know. Every week I'm going to have to come up with something. I don't know what.
I don't even know you anymore. I don't know what's going
on. No pressure.
So Microsoft today announced a new dashboard for the Xbox, and this time they made it pretty broadly, right? So this dashboard is coming to the Xbox One as well as to Xbox Series X and S, which they haven't announced yet. And this look and feel is going to make its way to the Xbox app everywhere, Windows 10 and on mobile as well. And it's an evolution of what we see today on the Xbox One. I mean, no surprise there. The big change, and this is something Mary Jo will love, is that the windows have rounded corners. So
I heard about that. And I was tempted to just start yelling the word fluent, but I did not.
Yes. I think it looks pretty. The big deal, I've talked about this a lot. One of the weird problems that Microsoft has gotten into with the Xbox, and this dates back to the 360, is that for some reason, even though this thing can play like the best, among the best games in the world and at great speeds, the interface of the system itself, like the dashboard, as we call it, has always been really slow. And with Xbox One, they've tried over multiple generations to try to fix that through, performance tweaks and so forth. And when that it really kind of ended, they just started making the UI more efficient. So there's fewer clicks to get to different places that you want to go and so forth. So this to me looks very much like the current version, slightly prettier. It's a nice look, I think. So this is and I don't know when is it. It's obviously not coming next week or anything, but I'd like to actually use it. It's probably going to be this fall.
I always appreciate these heads up because I like to know that I should turn on my Xbox a couple of days early.
Yes. Well, hopefully you're doing the trickle update thing, right? Where it's asleep, but if there's an update, it's still downloading it. Because I got to tell you, when you turn that thing on and want to play a game, it's
frustrating.
Just the worst.
And if you're casual like me, I don't play games that often. It's every time.
You just give up. You just say, forget it.
I don't want to play.
Okay. Yep.
Go ahead, update. I'll be back next year.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, it's pretty.
Good. I look forward to it.
We're in the second half of August. Microsoft twice each month makes an announcement about the games coming to Xbox Game Pass across. Oh, it's the last BioWare. Is it? I just noticed there was a game I thought I was going to be playing, but I already played it. So they announced the games coming to console and PC on Xbox Game Pass in the second half of the month. And there's some big ones. Flight Simulator is already there. Wasteland 3. I thought it was the next Resident Evil game, but actually it's the last one, and I already finished that game. So Resident Evil Biohazard, which I think is Resident Evil 7, is coming at the end of the month. So that's too bad. I was so excited for that. And then there was a game that Microsoft previewed at that Xbox Game Showcase called Tell Me Why, which is a multi-part game, like a binge kind of a thing. So the first part of that game will actually be available sometime in the second half of the month, and that's actually when I will be playing. But Battletoads is in there. New Super Lucky's Tale. So there was a Super Lucky's Tale, which I did play back when it first came out. There's a new version of that and several others. So actually, this is a really – sometimes these things come out and you're like, whatever. This is a good crop of new games. Like, this looks really nice. We did Flight Simulator already. Oh, and then the other one was, and also game related, is Microsoft announced the other day that they had hit this milestone for indie games. And so the indie game program at Microsoft is now called ID at Xbox. It used to have a different game, but since it switched to that name, there have been 2,000 independent games published on Xbox. And they have all these, you know, numbers, like they've given one, not given, but they've, well, given $1.5 billion in royalties have been paid out to these developers over that time period. And there's some big ones. So Cuphead is probably the biggest game that's come through this system. Goat Simulator is probably one people have heard of. Oxenfree, which was a pick I had in the past. Untitled Goose Game. There are games like I played through and really loved, like Inside is a really good one. And so, you know, from a from sort of a game perspective, I mean, everyone's probably at least passingly familiar with the, you know, Call of Duties of the world, the big games. But these games are written by small teams, sometimes even individuals. And there's some really cool stuff out there, something for everybody. So I don't really call this up when I do this. But if you look at that list of Game Pass games, a number of those are independent games or ID at Xbox games as well. So in addition to like the AAA titles, you get these independent games as well. There's some really nice stuff in there. Oh, Xbox Live Arcade. That was one of the original names of ID at Xbox. Anyway, so there's 2,000 now that you can play on Xbox.
That's
so
really neat. Neat, yeah.
Yeah,
I always think of PlayStation as being the kind of the king of indie games, but really that's a lot of games. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think that, yeah. They wrote, and, you know, Cuphead, which, you know, coincidentally is coming to PlayStation soon. If it hasn't already, it's heading to PlayStation. But that became as an that was an independent.
Yeah. Mary Jo Foley's favorite video game.
Well, it's got the
after
whole. You
I,
know,
like that, I said, after you guys talked about that game, I'm like, I'll never play that game. Yeah. It's really
it would be
hard.
An exercise in frustration.
Yeah, it like, would. Why don't they just release a
Cuphead easy,
a simple, easier game?
Right,
mode.
Beginner's mode.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's so off-putting because it's such a pretty game that I think.
Yeah.
Well, you're a proof of it. It attracts kind of a non-gamer audience. Could get people into gaming.
That's a really good
idea.
Interactive.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah, when I saw it, I was like, oh, that looks cool. And then when you guys talked about it, I was like, nope.
Yeah.
Teacup head.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Something easy. They really should. That's a good idea.
Why they don't?
Let's take a break, and then we're going to go to the back of the book. Paul Thurrott, Mary Jo Foley, Windows Weekly on the air. Our show today brought to you by this little canary I got sitting here on my desk, and I ain't talking a bird. I'm talking about the coolest little honeypot you ever did see. Which, if you're just tuning in, sounds weird, I know. But I'm talking about a security device that everybody should have on their network. These days, when your network is attacked, and this is the newest thing with ransomware, they get on your system, you know, usually through a spear phishing attack, something like that. They get in your system. They get in your company network. You're going to have this problem as people are working from home. They're going to get infected on their laptops. They're going to bring their laptops in. They're going to get on the network. But then used to be they just go, boom, ransomware. Now they sit there and they explore and they make the ransomware attack much worse. In a couple of ways. One, they're going to look at all the nooks and crannies, the places you back up and everything, and make sure they've got payloads everywhere so that your backups will also be encrypted. That's bad enough. Two, they exfiltrate data. This just happened to Canon. So Canon got bit, lost a lot of data. They started restoring it. The presumption was, oh, they must have paid the ransom. But no, I guess they just had good backups. So they started restoring it, kind of get back up and running. Now the bad guys have started to release tons of internal documents from Canon. Obviously, they didn't pay the ransom, and that was the second payload. And the way it happens is this: they call it advanced persistent threats, APT. They sit on your network. They wander around. It is more important than ever that you know if you've got an intruder. And believe me, these guys are clever. They don't leave footprints. They don't ring the front doorbell. They get in there and they snoop around secretly. But if you've got a canary, you've got something extra special. Data breaches are on the rise. Companies find out too late they've been compromised after spending millions on IT security. Canary is designed to be installed, configured, and forgotten.
I love it. I don't pay any attention to my canary. The only time I want to hear from my canary is if there's a problem. In fact, it's one of the few security devices you have that you don't want to hear from. But when you do get alerted, you know it's important. And Canary gives you the option of being alerted via email, text message, on a console. You get one with the Canary. They support Slack. They support webhooks, which means they support just about everything. Syslog. They have an API, so you can add it to your own code. And Canary alerts are exactly what they should be. Dead, simple, and easy to work with. Conforming to your needs, not the other way around. You won't be inundated with alerts either. You'll get one when it matters. And it'll be an actionable alert that you can look at and say, oh, I know what I need to do now. Two things companies know when it comes to data breaches. Hackers take the path of least resistance, your staff, right? That's why 91% of all attacks come through email. But the other statistic may shock you a little bit. On average, it takes 191 days for a company to realize they've been breached. That's more than 6 months. That's what happened with Sony. That's what happened with Norsk Hydro. I've been talking about that one. That's a fascinating ransomware story. The company that makes these little things, Thinkst, has been around for almost two decades. They've trained companies, militaries, they've trained governments how to break into networks, and they've used what they've learned, what they know, to build this device. Thinkst Canaries are deployed all over the world on all seven continents, including Antarctica. They're one of the best tools you can get against data breaches. So here's how it works. They're really little appliances. You connect, you configure, they can be anything. They can be a switch, a router, a NAS server, a Linux box, a Windows server. You could have Windows servers from any year. It matches the MAC address. It matches the login page. Everything looks real. These canaries don't look vulnerable to a bad guy. They look valuable. You can't tell the difference. You can put fake files on them. You can enroll them in Active Directory. And the minute attackers investigate further, they give themselves away. You're notified. There's somebody in the network. Here's what that person's doing. You can also make canary tokens with your canary, which are files you could put anywhere, PDFs, Excel documents, Word. They aren't really. They look like it. I have a few spreadsheets spread around that say payroll info, things like that. Somebody tries to open it, I get the notification immediately. They give themselves away, and that's the key. Go to canary.tools/love if you want to read all the tweets from people who use canaries, some very big names on there, and why they love their canary so much. And when you're ready to buy, go to canary.tools/twit. I'll give you an example, the price, okay? I think this is very fairly done. $7,500 a year for five canaries. You get a hosted console. You get upgrades. You get support. You get maintenance. Anything happens to a canary, they send you a new one. No big deal. By the way, you can make it even more affordable if you use the offer code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box, 10% off the price, and not just in your first purchase, but forever. And if at any time you're not happy with your canary, you have a 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. So try it for 60 days. It's completely no risk, just to get an idea. But, you know, I got to warn you, if you put it on there for 60 days and you hear nothing, that's good. That's a good thing. Canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. We really love our Thinkst Canaries, and I think you will too. Thinkst, T-H-I-N-K-S-T, Canary. It's at canary.tools, canary.tools/twit. Canary.tools/twit. And don't forget the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box to get 10% off for life. Now to the back of the book, we herald the return of one Paul Thurrott for the
tip. So actually, what was the phrase we had come up with for this episode?
The impression of fairness.
Yeah. So why don't we give the impression of fairness, and Mary Jo could do this tip.
What?
Because honestly, it's more about her than it is about me.
Well, that's awesome. Go ahead.
Okay.
Teamwork.
So over on Petri.com, I do a podcast called MJF Chat. And recently, I had on as my special guest, Paul Thurrott.
Recently, she ran out of ideas for guests. And she said, hey.
I like to mix up the kind of topics I do. So I do very product-specific topics, and then I do some softer topics, especially about careers and learning. And so I knew Paul had a lot of good ideas about how to motivate yourself to keep learning throughout your career. So I had to twist his arm a little to come on, but he did.
I told some really good lightning strike and an internet outage.
I know. He pretended his house got hit by lightning so he didn't have to come on. But then, a week later, I'm just like, really? Okay. That's an inventive excuse. But when he did come on, he was as good as I thought he would be. And he had a lot of good stories and tips and tricks to stay motivated, resources. So if you haven't been able to get enough of me and Paul talking to each other through Windows Weekly, go over to petri.com and look for MJF chat, and you can watch us or listen to us do a chat about lifelong learning.
You should listen. You should check out the podcast too. I mean, who else has been on there? Yeah. I know Michael Niehaus was recent.
He ended up not being on, but there's a long story about that, but we've had a lot of different guests on talking about a lot of different topics. I've had Thomas Maurer on recently talking about Azure Hybrid. I've had people on about Cortana, the Microsoft Graph, just a whole host of different topics. And we're going to have a very interesting guest coming on later, I think in a couple months. Ant Pruitt is going to come on the show and talk about personal branding. We've got a lot of different people, some of whom you may know, some of whom you may not, but 30-minute commitment, very short episodes where you can get a lot of good ideas.
Yeah. It was great. It was great doing it.
Sounds great.
Thanks.
I really enjoyed the extra week off, too. That was nice.
Well, I think it's interesting. So you're talking about careers, which is something we never hear Paul talk about.
Well, it's more about, careers with the understanding that, especially if you're in the technology field, I mean, you need to keep learning. And I've told the story on this podcast, but I always reference that pre-con session we did at TechEd where people were moving their companies to the cloud. This was still kind of controversial. And this guy kind of stood up in the middle of the thing and said, let me get this straight. I'm going to move, as my last act as exchange administrator, I'm going to move my company to the cloud. And it's like, but... You know, when people started that kind of a job, they understood that this was all about change, but then they got comfortable and they did three series of exchange, version-to-version upgrades, and they thought that was what their world was. But the world changes, and that's what our market is all about. And so, we all have different interests and areas we might want to look into. But the nice thing about today, for all of the awfulness, is there are lots of great resources online, no matter what you want to do. If it's programming in my case or IT, there's all kinds of amazing online resources and different types of resources. Some people like to read. Some people like the video stuff, nano degrees, online courses, certifications. Yeah. It's incredible.
Nice.
Yeah. I'll keep learning. You know, it's like I don't know if I use this example, but it's like, a shark will die if it doesn't keep swimming. I mean, I feel like people die if they don't keep learning,
Right. Yeah, Paul wanted us to call the episode Learn or Die, but I vetoed that.
It was a little harsh.
Maybe we could have a more upbeat title.
Yep.
App picks. You got a few, Paul.
Yeah, so Flight Simulator, of course. It's available on the PC only right now. There are three different SKUs. I couldn't tell you what the differences are. It is the standard SKU that's available on Xbox Game Pass for PC or Ultimate, and probably the one that most people are going to get. So obviously that's an awesome game. We've talked a lot about the Brave web browser. For people who really care about privacy, it's probably the best choice. Microsoft Edge, Opera, even Vivaldi, probably more mainstream Chrome alternatives, but if you're concerned about privacy, Brave is a good choice. If it has one downside so far, it's been the way they handle sync, because they're trying to do things in a way that where your data is never stored by Brave the company, and it rendered the initial sync system kind of lame, frankly. But they've completely they've replaced it. So they've ripped and replaced. They have a new sync system. If you haven't looked at it in a while, you might want to take another look at it, especially if sync was the concern. The other thing I just wanted to mention, this is almost a tip, frankly. Google has a service called Takeout. And the point of Takeout is that you sign into your Google account and it shows you all the data they have of yours. And this is everything from your Drive data, literally the files that are in Drive, to your chat messages. If you're a Google Fi customer, it's got it, depending on what you use for from Google, it could have, I mean, a thousand different things. And I knew about this, but I hadn't really looked at it in a while. And I got an email from them because I switched recently from Google Play Music to YouTube Music. So they sent an email saying, hey, by the way, it looks like everything went fine, but here is just some, you know, little reminders. And one of them was about Google Takeout, because one of the things that's in Google Takeout, if you were or are a Google Play Music customer, is any music that you uploaded to the service. Remember, one of the key things about it was, I think it was 50,000, but maybe now it's 100,000. Even a free user could upload their own music to the service and then stream it from anywhere. It's incredible. That stuff is available for download. If you purchase music from Google, it's available for download. And so I thought, yeah, I should download this just to see what that looks like. And my God, you could make a career out of downloading your data from Google.
Oh yeah.
If you had asked me before I did this, like, how many songs do you think I uploaded? I would have guessed somewhere between 75 and 100, maybe. I don't remember the numbers in the article, but I believe it's 6,173. It's some crazy number. And I don't remember doing that. I can only imagine, because I don't remember this, but I did switch to Google Play Music at one time, and it's possible that I used a third-party service to pull music out of Groove or whatever I was using right before that, and maybe it went in. I don't know. I don't know. God knows. Honestly, it looks like most of the music I have in my account, but it took – because the download comes in the form of 2 gigabyte files. I had 25 of them, and it took a long time to download, but – they give you metadata for the songs, and in CSV files, they have the playlists, you know, radio stations, things I don't really care about. All I wanted was the MP3 files. So they're high quality MP3 files. I backed them up to my NAS, I mean, you know, whatever, just in case. I probably already have them somewhere else, frankly, because I guess I'm the one who I uploaded most of them. Some of them were purchases, but it was kind of an interesting exercise. And I guess, you know, again, most people listening to this probably have a Google account. You should take the time to go take a look at what's in Takeout for you. And I think Takeout, it's probably google.com/takeout is the address. If not, you can just Google Takeout, obviously. But I think you'd be surprised, you know, how much stuff is in there, depending on what you do with Google.
Yeah, I took out my photos.
Yeah, right. That is a big one.
264 2 gigabyte files, because they won't give you more than 2 gigabytes at a chunk.
Yeah, yeah.
So right. They're 2 gigabyte zip files.
So was that like a week-long episode of downloading and babysitting the
downloads? I had to come to work because, you can't. And there's not one button to download at all. You have to download each individually.
You have to babysit it. Yep.
So that was a lot of clicking. once I got them, then you have to unzip them, and they're not in any order. And there's a lot of XML files along with the JPEGs. So I had to write a hefty script to process.
Yeah.
Eventually, after a little experimentation, I got a script that would unzip, process, get rid of the stuff I couldn't use, and organize the stuff I could use, even rename it. Because the other thing that is a problem is that the file, and this is just the operating systems do this, the file creation date becomes the day you downloaded it or unzipped it. And so that was useless for photos. So I had to go through it all and change the creation dates based on it was, but you know what? It was fun
date,
project.
Yeah, you can do it. There's a date taken thing that's still in there.
It's in the exif, so I was able to get it.
So by the way, so the MP3 file, so I think I was right. It's 6,173 is the number. Like photos, it's just like in a terrible names all in one folder. Bloop. But you got to remember, like, modern operating systems like Windows 10 have the ability, like if you have a folder full of MP3 files, it knows that it's music. And so it provides you with these ways to sort it that you don't get. So I've done that, you know, it's a little slow because it's like 6,000 files, but you can group by, and I've done this as by album, you know, or by artist or however you want to do it. And all of a sudden this mess of bleh comes into like, oh, look, it makes sense. Like it's, and you know, the good news is if obviously you might be downloading this because you're leaving Google or you're trying to use a different service or you want that stuff somewhere else, whatever it is. But the metadata in the files should, photos and music, I hope, carry through, and then you can, you know, if you were to upload this to, I don't know where I would put it, some other service, Apple or whatever, you know, it should, I mean, there'll be mistakes, right? I mean, it's going to be little orphaned files and so forth, but I don't know. I mean, I'm glad to have it. I'm glad, you know, it's nice that you're able to do this at all.
Yeah. I mean,
I guess it doesn't.
You know, there's supposedly GDPR requires this of every company, but Google did it first for, you know, forever.
Yeah, I think it's been around for a while.
Oh, since the beginning. It was Brad Fitzpatrick's idea, which he took to the Google higher-ups and said, you know, we really should always have a way to get your data back out. And they created Google Takeout. And it's, to this day, it's the one thing that reassures me that Google isn't fully evil.
Isn't fully evil.
Well, unlike most other silos.
Maybe we shouldn't promote this because they might have forgotten it exists.
It's a good thing to remember. Just be prepared to have to deal with these files because... It's quite
a fun
thing.
Embarrassment for me because these albums are alphabetical. The very first one is .. Baby One More Time, which is a Britney Spears album, which I'm super proud that I own.
Hit me, baby, one more time. Oh, baby, baby, how was I supposed to know?
Yeah, I'm going to delete that one. Thanks for
So they're telling me that there is a setting, which apparently I missed, that lets you make the files 50 gigs. So
are you serious?
Wish I'd seen that. Yeah.
Yep.
Wish I'd seen that.
Well, that's good to know. So if you're going to download photos, especially, I must have hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes of photos. Google.
Oh yeah.
Must.
Yeah. It was quite a multi-day effort, but you know, the good news is all my photos are in Google Photos. So, you know, I didn't lose anything from any camera, any photo, any phone, anything. So that's nice.
Yep.
Let's do an enterprise pick of the week. And for that, in interest of fairness, or at least the appearance thereof, Mary Jo Foley.
Yes. My enterprise pick is a blog post that was on the Azure blog this week. And it's all about how Microsoft is trying to improve how they communicate with customers when there's an Azure outage. So I was very interested to see this one because... As many reporters know, every time there's an outage on any cloud service, all you have to do is open Twitter and you'll see many people tweeting to you and others about it and like really kind of losing it over, we don't know what's happening. It's been down for hours. No one's telling us what's going on. Can you please call Microsoft and ask them for us? So the Azure team actually has a 5-pronged plan to try to make this a better experience. And they've done some of these things already. So I notice that less and less, they're not really using the Azure status page to communicate with people. Before, if something was down anywhere in the world in Azure, they'd put a notice up on the Azure status page and you'd see all the little green flags turn to red flags, right? And then you'd be like, oh, there's an outage. But now what they're doing instead is when there's an outage, if it's not a massive outage affecting many regions, they're using their own service health service to communicate with the administrators and say, we're going to send you a note in your portal about exactly what's going on, which regions are affected and where we're at in fixing it. So they've taken something that was a very public kind of scattershot approach to talking to people about outages to something much more finite and dedicated and customized to what's going on with their particular tenants in their data centers. So in many ways, I applaud them for this, and I think this is really good, and they have to get customers out of the habit of going to the Azure status page to look when something like this happens and instead look on their own portals in Service Health and see what's going on. I will also say not all of this, I'm sure, is out of the goodness of their heart. They don't want to see us writing stories saying Azure outage, blah, 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 right? So by taking this private and making it something where they're not talking about it in a public forum, it's harder for us to get stories about Azure outages unless they're really, really big or unless customers come to us about something happening. The other takeaway I had from this blog post was, because this has been so successful for Azure and they're continuing to try to hone it more using AI, of course, because everything uses AI, making it more automated and not relying so much on people to be the ones sending the information to the customers. They're going to take this too to Microsoft 365 and the Power Platform, all these procedures and processes. So don't expect to see as much about Office 365 or Power Platform outages on Twitter or in public facing pages, and instead expect that to be in customer portals as well in the future.
Interesting.
Yeah. I was wondering why we weren't hearing about Azure outages. I'm like, it's not because Azure's so perfect. Something else is happening. Right?
Shut your mouth.
Secret.
I know. Mark Rusinovich is like back there going, Mary Jo, Azure is perfect.
It's perfect.
It's perfect.
I mean, and I can prove it with Matt.
Yes. How about your code name of the week?
Yep. So this is a code name from the past, Project Osaka. Project Osaka was going to be a lists application in Microsoft 365. It also went by the name at one point of CollabDB. But because somebody at Microsoft said, wait a minute, we already have SharePoint lists. Why are we going to have a lists app in Office 365? They canceled Project Osaka. But here's the interesting thing. Microsoft just came out with a new app in Microsoft 365 called Lists. It's starting to roll out now to people who have commercial subscriptions to Microsoft 365. And Tony Redmond over on Petri looked into this app and checked it out. And he said, you know what? There's a lot of Project Osaka in this app. So Project Osaka didn't really die. It's been reborn and reimagined, Microsoft's favorite word, as part of the new Microsoft Lists app. So I thought that was interesting. Project Osaka has come back in many ways.
We never knew it was gone.
I know. Yeah. 2017, it went off the radar screen, and now it's back on the screen.
CollabDB. I want a beer. I want some beer. And if I can make a request, like a beer that's just like a dessert.
Yes. Why not?
That's what I need right now.
So, you know, we talk about a lot of the dark beers as being very dessert-like, coffee, cocoa, chocolate. But you know what? Sours can be dessert-like, too. Mm. And Westbrook Brewing out of South Carolina makes a beer called Lemon Meringue Pie. Does it taste like it? Yes, it does.
Really? I want it.
Yes, it does. Well. So they make it with vanilla, lemon, milk, sugar, graham crackers, and cinnamon when they actually brew it. And so you get all those flavors that you would get in a lemon meringue pie in your beer. And the best part, it's a sour and it's only 4%. So it's not some heavy, you know, 10%, 12% stout or milkshake IPA. This is a true sour, but it does taste a lot like lemon meringue pie.
Sours aren't sour.
No, they don't have to be really sour. Some sours are as sour as vinegar. And some people like that.
Right.
But other sours are more fruity and almost sweet, a little sweet sour thing going on. This is one of those.
Sounds good. I could use some lemon meringue pie right now.
Yeah. And the reason I made it the pick this week is it's available in cans now, so it's being much more widely distributed than it was before.
Awesome.
So you can probably find it if you really want to.
I do. I do. Folks, that's about it for this edition of Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley, thank you so much. We do this show every Wednesday around 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That would be 1800 UTC. If you want to watch live or listen live, there's a stream or two at twit.tv/live. You can pick your poison there. If you are watching or listening live, chat room's a great place to hang. That's irc.twit.tv. After the fact, on-demand versions of the show are always available at our website, twit.tv/ww. There's a Windows Weekly channel on YouTube, all the shows there. You can ask your favorite voice assistant to play the Windows Weekly podcast, and it should get the latest version up and running. Or actually, the best thing to do, get your favorite podcast program and subscribe. That way you'll get it the minute it's available of a Wednesday afternoon. Paul Thurrott's at Thurrott.com. His books, including The Field Guide to Windows 10, available at leanpub.com. Mary Jo Foley blogs at ZDNet, all about Microsoft.com. And they'll be back right here next week because they don't have anything else to do.
We're not leaving the house, folks. Not a lot going on.
What else are you going to do during a quarantine but do more podcasts? Thanks, guys. It's really great to talk to you. And we'll see you next week on Windows Weekly. Bye-bye.
I'm Jason Howell, host of Tech News Weekly here on twit.tv, along with my co-host, Micah Sargent. Each and every week, we talk to people who are making and breaking the tech news. It could be journalists writing amazing tech stories, could be experts, it could be the sources of the stories themselves, developers, you name it. We bring them onto the show, and we talk to them about why their story is resonating with the world. You can watch and subscribe by going to twit.tv/TNW. Make sure you do that and you won't miss a single episode. We'll see you there.
Bless you. Usually after I sneeze like that, I always say, I'm okay. Nobody ever
just
asks.
A little bit of my brain's coming out. It's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Just I just lost 7 days of childhood memories, but I'm good.